want to tell you a little bit about our guest because he has some fantastic credentials. Robert M. Schock, Ph.D., is a full-time faculty member in the areas of science and mathematics at the College of General Studies at Boston University. He's been there since 1984. He earned his Ph.D. in geology and geophysics from Yale University. Since 1990, Dr. Schock has been researching the age of the Great Sphinx. Based on his geological studies, he's determined that the Sphinx's origins go back to pre-dynastic times, thousands of years older than previously thought. This research formed the basis of the Emmy-winning documentary, The Mystery of the Sphinx, in which Dr. Schock is featured and is also discussed in his book, Voices of the Rocks, A Scientist Looks at Catastrophes and Ancient Civilizations. In recent years, Dr. Schock has expanded his research to encompass pyramids and associated structures around the world, and that's the subject of his latest book, the one we're talking about tonight, Voyages of the Pyramid Builders, The True Origins of the Pyramids from Lost Egypt to Ancient America. Dr. Schock has lectured widely and is the author or co-author of numerous papers, reviews, abstracts, and several other books, including the textbook, Environmental Science, Systems and Solutions. In recognition of his geological and paleontological contributions, in 1993, the new genus Schockia, an extinct group of fossil mammals, was named in his honor. Dr. Schock, thank you for being with us.
Well, thank you very much.
Tell me, before we get into the pyramid talk, what is a Schockia? What is a new genus? I think it's great.
It's a group of animals that's now extinct, lived about 60 million or so years ago, and they were sort of cat-sized. I guess the best way to think of them is like they weren't really cats, but to the average eye, they might have sort of looked like cats.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I thought that was sort of neat. Not everyone gets an animal named after them.
No, that's true. I've heard of people having stars named after them, but not animals named after them. Do we know, what part of the world were they in?
Lived in Western North America.
Oh, so they're sort of one of ours.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, very good. I'm fascinated in your background because you teach science and mathematics. You're a geologist.
Correct.
And yet you've gotten off into this wonderfully fascinating area of the Sphinx and the pyramids. How did you, was it a transition or do you do everything all at the same time?
Oh, I guess I sort of do everything all at the same time. I'm still a geologist. I still do other types of science. But I've always been fascinated by ancient cultures and ancient civilization, even as a young child, decades ago. So it never seemed, it doesn't seem strange to me to take scientific techniques, to take my background as a geologist and apply them to ancient monuments. After all, what we know of ancient cultures is very much tied up or wrapped up with their buildings, their structures, their stonework that has survived. So that's my, seems appropriate that geologists should look at such things in my mind.
Well, realistically, they built the structures out of stone, and that's what geologists study. And the thing that always struck me was how, in a way, flimsy and frail our own structures are, and then you look back to these ancient civilizations, regardless of which continent you're looking at, and these things have lasted for centuries and centuries. I mean,
exactly.
I've, as you were and are, I have always been fascinated with Egypt and Central and South America, and with the main question of how did they do what they did, and how did they survive?
Exactly.
Did they know something we don't know?
It's a difficult question because there's many different levels. I think at some fundamental levels they did know things that we don't know. And I don't mean that in any kind of strange technological way. I think just sort of their philosophical outlook, their perspective on history, how they saw themselves relative to the cosmos was maybe different than the way we moderns tend to view ourselves. I think we tend to be very insular, very in the moment versus having a longer-term perspective on things, which I believe they tend to have.
In other words, they saw themselves as part of, if you will, eternity, and so
exactly.
they built these massive
exactly.
monuments to survive?
Exactly. I think because you look at some of these monuments, whether it's Egypt or Mesoamerica, and they are incredibly, we would say, overbuilt. You know, way, way more massive, way stronger. I mean, they're built to last, or, I mean, it's way beyond the function of the moment, should we say.
Yeah.
And we just don't necessarily put the time and effort into things like that.
Well, we tend to, especially I think in this country, and perhaps more out west, which is where I live, than Easterners. Certainly,
mm-hmm.
one of the failings of California was as soon as something got old, they tore it down and built something new.
Oh, absolutely.
And whereas back east, there is, or has been at least, a tendency to try to preserve old structures for the sake of history.
Exactly.
But we don't have anything exactly. that comes anywhere close to lasting.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, it's I don't know. I think it's just a very different mentality, if you would, back then.
You got interested in the Sphinx, and as I understand it, current knowledge is that it has a longer history than we ever dreamed. Give us an idea of how you got started getting interested in it and what you found out.
Okay, the Sphinx itself, which really was the... I've always been interested in ancient history and cultures, as I said, you know, since a very young age. But I got involved in the Sphinx very specifically due to John Anthony West, which I'm sure you and some of your listeners know about his work in Egypt.
Mm-hmm.
And he first got me involved. Actually, one of these very circuitous things, he happened to know another faculty member at Boston University, and we were introduced, you know, sort of through mutual friends, that type of thing. And he got me first specifically interested in the Sphinx. At that time, the conventional dogma, if you would, or the traditional idea was that the Sphinx was carved out of the rock at Giza in Egypt about 2500 B.C. West wasn't sure if this was exactly the, you know, correct solution to the puzzle, because there's no... documentary evidence. There's no inscriptions that say when the Sphinx was carved, when it was built. And he asked me to look at it as a geologist. And people before him, including 19th century Egyptologists, had questions about when the Sphinx was built, how old it was. But in the 20th century, it had sort of crystallized what was 2500 B.C. I went and I looked at it, and what I found based on my research was that, in fact, there was a component of about 2500 B.C. to the Sphinx, but, in fact, this structure had a much, much earlier history. And to get to the conclusion, the core structure, the oldest portions of the Sphinx, by my estimation, by my dating, goes back to at least 5,000 to 7,000 BC, maybe earlier.
Wow, that's a huge difference.
Exactly, exactly. And it's such a huge difference that it really says something important about what's going on the Giza Plateau. Where did Egypt come from? Because we're talking, in traditional terms, pre-dynastic Egypt, yet you've got this monumental structure going back, you know, essentially thousands of years before dynastic Egypt, which was unimaginable 10 years ago.
When you say that the oldest portion of it, are you saying that it was built in steps?
No, well, actually, it was sort of built in steps. I would say it was more built and recarved. So it gets a little complicated. For instance, everyone thinks of the Sphinx as being this recumbent lion, sitting on the plateau, it faces east, with the head of a human, head
mm-hmm.
of a man or woman, depending on your interpretation. In fact, that head, I've determined, is clearly not the original head. It's been
really?
Recarved. Yeah, so that's
wow.
that's a fourth, well, maybe not fourth dynasty, but it's a dynastic head, probably, by my best estimate, first or second dynasty, but
mm-hmm.
dynastic head, but it's not the original head, so that gets confusing right there. But the body, what I call the oldest portion, goes back much earlier. Then it was adopted by the dynastic Egyptians. They recarved the head. They modified it. they did some carving in the rear portions of it. So it's this structure, and if you look at Europe, medieval, modern-day Europe, you get the same type of thing where you do have nothing as old as the Sphinx, perhaps, but, you know, cathedrals that have been rebuilt, reused, taken over, in some cases, you know, turned from one purpose to another.
Mm-hmm.
In terms, the same in the Sphinx.
In terms of the Sphinx, when you say they recarve the head, do you mean that the stone is the original stone, but what it looks like changed, or did
Correct.
They in fact put another head on it?
No, the head is, it's interesting. The head is, that is original stone, but if you look at the Sphinx, and this is something that struck me the first time I ever went there, and I was not expecting it, the Sphinx, the head of the Sphinx is too small proportionally for the body. And it's in different proportions to all other sphinxes known in ancient Egypt. The head is just too small for the body. And what I'm absolutely, you know, convinced is the case is that originally it had another head, which would have been in proportion to the body. I believe that became very heavily weathered and eroded over time. And they literally recarved it. So when you recarve it, it has to become smaller. Which is why
true.
It's too small for the body at this point. I mean, it doesn't look that bad if you're not thinking about it.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't mean to belittle the Sphinx. It's a beautiful structure. But it, in fact, if you start looking and measuring and comparing the proportions, the head's too small. So yes, it's the original stone, but the surfaces have all been reworked.
Now, you said that from it's different in terms of proportion from all of the other sphinxes
in Egypt.
Where are there others
there
and what do they look like?
There are many sphinxes around Egypt from the Old Kingdom, later in the Old Kingdom, when I say Old Kingdom, 4th, 5th, 6th Dynasty.
Mm-hmm.
There are plenty of sphinxes from Middle New Kingdom times. Some of them are, you know, tens of feet long, nothing close to the Great Sphinx, which is, you know, several hundred feet long.
Mm-hmm.
But there are many sphinxes, both freestanding, carved as reliefs, et cetera. And if you look at all of these and measure the basic proportions, you know, head to body length, width of the face, relative to width of body, et cetera, they all fall pretty much within a canon, within common dimensions, except for the Great Sphinx.
Now, what about the theory that possibly wind and sand and erosion could have caused that difference in size?
Yeah, I've looked at that very carefully. In fact, that's been a major feature of my research, is looking at the erosion of the Sphinx. One thing that I determined, and this has since been confirmed, I'm happy to say, by independent geological research by other geologists who went out there, like I said, totally independent of me, is that the predominant features of erosion and weathering on the base of the Sphinx, on the body of the Sphinx, actually are due to, of all things, water, precipitation, rainfall, which
mm-hmm.
is interesting because of anyone that's been to Egypt knows that the Sphinx and the Giza Plateau and the pyramids, they sit on the edge of the Sahara Desert. So you don't get a lot of rain nowadays. But what you do get, if you go back geologically, is before about 3000 BC, you get a very different climatic conditions in that region. And those climatic conditions correlate with the type of erosional features you see on the oldest portions of the Sphinx. Again,
one other question before we get past it on the other sphinxes from the later dynasties.
Mm-hmm.
Are the heads on those the same as the head on the Great Sphinx?
Some of them are and some of them aren't. Classic sphinxes from other dynasties have humanoid heads, human heads.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes you get heads that are very, very specifically, we can recognize them, that they're meant to be pharaohs, specific pharaohs. Sometimes they're more generic. Classic Egyptian Sphinx is a lion's body and a human head.
Right.
In some cases, you get variations on that theme. So you get sphinxes with ram's heads or sphinxes with what you could say is a lion's head but with human features on it.
Mm-hmm.
So it looks more lion-like, if you would.
Yeah.
And then that grades all the way into things that we would not call sphinxes, but are similar to sphinxes in the sense that they are recumbent lions, more or less lions' bodies with lions' heads.
Did they have any special significance that you're aware of?
Sphinxes?
Yeah.
They tended to serve as guardian-type statues are, you know, sort of represent guardian type deities, sometimes associate with openings or closings in the sense of both in a literal sense and a metaphorical sense. So you'll see sphinxes lined up perhaps at the entrance to a temple,
mm-hmm.
By the sides of a door. That's very common for them to occur in pairs. Some people have suggested on that basis that there must be a mate, if you would, to the great sphinx.
I was going to ask you that because,
yeah.
You know, when you see them, usually there are two of them and they look, you know, very formidable. Why would they build just one?
Just one. Well, that's a good question. Again, I think that the Great Sphinx is clearly the prototypical sphinx, both in age and what would have been the original proportion. Some people have suggested, and I'm not advocating this, that there's another sphinx on the other side of the Giza Plateau, somewhere buried in the sand. The Great Sphinx that we know sits on the eastern portion of the Giza Plateau, where the three most famous pyramids in Egypt are,
mm-hmm.
And it faces east, basically faces the rising sun. Some people suggested that maybe in terms of pairs and symmetry, there would be one on the other side facing west. I don't know of any actual material evidence for one. But on the other hand, in Egypt, you know, there's still a lot
possible
to learn and explore and discover.
And have they ever searched for it? I mean, I know that they found some of the new living areas around the pyramids,
right,
where they think that, you know, the workers lived, and they've just found some amazing things.
Oh, yeah.
After all these years.
Yeah,
it's
exactly
certainly possible that something could be buried in the sand.
Yeah, I would not say it's impossible. Has there been a systematic search for it? Not that I'm aware of. I mean, one thing that I and other people would like to do, I've done some geophysical studies around the Giza Plateau, and we found interesting things like a cavity under the left paw of the Sphinx that was unknown previously. I'd like to extend those studies someday to other areas, both around Giza Plateau, the Giza Plateau, and also in other parts of Egypt. So, you know, maybe we'll find something.
Well, that would be wonderful. Let's go back to this mysterious creature that's sitting there on the plateau. You mentioned the doing the geophysical studies and finding things inside of it. At this point of what we know, it was not something that people went into. It wasn't a building. But
no.
Then again, with what you're finding out, maybe it did have some other kind of purpose. We're at the bottom of the hour. We'll take a quick pause. And when we come back, we'll continue with my guest, Dr. Robert M. Schock. We're talking about the Sphinx and the pyramids in Egypt, and so much more, because they're all around the world. And how did they get there? We'll find out on Coast to Coast AM. I'm Barbara Simpson.
Coast AM with Barbara Simpson.
This is Barbara Simpson with you on Coast to Coast AM. I want to remind you to get your very own subscription to the After Dark newsletter. It comes out once a month. We call it a newsletter. I mean, it is the official Coast to Coast AM newsletter, but in reality, it's a great little magazine that you'll get every month. You'll get 14 issues for the price of 12. It's slick paper, great articles. You have a monthly quickening news section. George does an editorial every month, and lots of interesting articles based on some of the guests we have here on Coast and other information as well. Now, you can get your own subscription two ways. As I mentioned, you get two issues free, so you'll get 14 for the price of 12, and the price is $39.95 a year. You can subscribe online. Go to coasttocoastam.com. Do it that way. It's a secure server to order, or use our toll-free phone number. Just pick up the phone, 888-727-5505. 888-727-5505. It's not too late for a Valentine's gift. Keep that in mind. I'm Barbara Simpson. This is Coast. We're talking with Dr. Robert Schock about his research into the Sphinx and the pyramids. In terms of the Sphinx, were you got involved in it because you met this other professor at Boston University. Did they request that you look into it, and what happened from there?
Well, what happened is I met another professor. We became friends. He's no longer at Boston University, but it was an English professor. Mm-hmm. And he happened to know a fellow named John Anthony West, who's we'll call him an independent Egyptologist. He's done a lot of work in Egypt, very knowledgeable, written a lot about Egypt. And he was aware of the work of one of his predecessors by the name of Schwaller de Lubitsch, who had suggested in a relatively obscure publication, should we say, that maybe the Sphinx was older than dynastic Egypt, or at least the Fourth Dynasty.
Mm-hmm.
And the fellow I knew, the English professor, who knew this Egyptologist, John Anthony West, who's since become a very good friend and colleague, thought that maybe he and I, John Anthony West and I, should get together to talk about things because, the Sphinx is made out of stone, and if you're going to date something, maybe you should ask a geologist.
And that's what you did.
And that's exactly what I did. So that's how I got involved in the immediate sense, how I got involved with Egypt and pyramids. Like I said, I always had an interest in such things, but it was that immediate contact. Over a dozen years ago now, that got me involved in this project.
You mentioned the geophysical studies. What were they, and what did you find?
What we did, and when I say we now, I got together with another colleague, Tom DeBecky, who's a Houston geophysicist, very good geophysicist. And what we did is we went over to Egypt. We took seismic equipment, and I'll explain it really quickly. What we did is we took basically a steel plate, and we put it down in spots around the Sphinx and elsewhere on the Giza Plateau. You hammer on it with a sledgehammer. This generates energy, essentially sound waves, that go down into the rock, and then they essentially bounce around there, and we can pick them up with what are known as geophones, basically microphones. And you can record how quickly the energy waves, the sound waves, travel through the rock, what they bounce off of, so you can get all kinds of information about the density of the rock, where there might be cavities, et cetera. And what we found was two main things. One, I was very interested, and this is why we did it initially, I was very interested in looking at subsurface weathering features, how the mineralogy has changed in the rock, and this occurs with time, occurs since it's been carved. So that gave me a very good handle. I could calibrate that to figure out how old the oldest portions of the Sphinx are.
I see.
And that tied right in with the other data I had on climate and erosion on the surface, which we had mentioned before the break. Secondly, and this was the most exciting to a lot of people, we found essentially what is a discontinuous, I'll describe it sort of as a tunnel along the length of the body of the Sphinx underneath, not in
really?
The body, but actually underneath.
Mm-hmm.
And also there seems to be a cavity, or I should say there is a cavity or chamber under the, basically under the left paw of the Sphinx. And neither of these were known previously. We also found a hole or cavity under the rump of the Sphinx on the left side, but that was already known to have been there. In fact, that latter feature seems to be something that is much younger than the Sphinx. It's ancient, but in ancient times some people thought, well, maybe there's treasure buried under the Sphinx, and they tried to sort of tunnel in.
And
so we found that, not knowing it was there, but Zai Hawass, the Egyptologist in charge of the Giza Plateau and actually all antiquities in Egypt at this point, already knew it was there. So that was nice. It confirmed that
mm-hmm.
our techniques were working properly.
Sure.
But then we found this cavity, which was unknown until we found it, and has yet to be explored, under the left paw of the Sphinx. I'll just throw this out because I'm sure some of the listeners are aware of it. Edgar Cayce, I don't know that much about him, but I guess we call him did psychic work. I don't know
yes.
if that's the correct term. He had, interestingly, and this was unbeknownst to me, predicted some kind of cavity or chamber under the Sphinx. Sometimes I believe referred to as the Hall of Records. So
mm-hmm.
I'm not claiming we found that, but we did find something under the left paw, which has yet to be entered and explored.
In your finding of it, were you able to determine the size of this cavity?
Not real precisely. I mean, it's decent size. It's maybe...
Meaning what?
Oh, maybe 30 feet on the side.
That's pretty big.
Yeah. I mean, it's not a small structure. It's not like a little, 5 foot by 5 foot
yeah.
structure. But it's hard to delineate that precisely with the seismic data. At first, I was thinking, well, as a geologist, the first thing I thought is it's some kind of natural feature, some
mm-hmm.
kind of natural structure. But the data we were getting back, it's very regular. It doesn't look like a natural, cave or...
A hole in the rock.
A hole in the rock, exactly. It's very, very, very regular, rectangular. Also seems to be what I would call, as a geologist, rubble-filled. Now, what's the rubble? It could be that the ceiling on it collapsed, so it's literally rubble, rock rubble. It could be filled with, to take the other extreme, gold vessels.
Mm-hmm.
And someday I think we'll learn.
How would you find out? Would you have to drill through, go
yeah.
under, or use technology to see through the stone?
Yeah, we might be able to, and discussing the politics of Egypt, which is why
yeah.
more has not been done so far, I might be able to do some more refined remote sensing geophysical techniques to get better feel of exactly the size and structure of it. Ultimately, though, you'd want to enter it to know exactly what is there. You could maybe drill into it and put down a fiber optic camera. That would be
mm-hmm.
one possibility. You may be familiar that on the Giza Plateau, they're later than I believe this chamber is, but around the Great Pyramid, for instance, boat pits, ancient boat pits, where they found solar boats, as they sometimes refer to them.
Yes.
And in some of those, for instance, National Geographic, I believe it was drilled into it and put down a fiber optic camera to see what was in it before it was actually opened up.
Well, they used the camera in the passageways in the pyramid, too.
Exactly. In fact, they did sound, I guess, on live TV.
Yes, they did. I saw that.
But I watched that going up and inserting. So there are different possibilities like that, but all of them involve risks. of course. Because
what's the risk?
Well, for instance, if a chamber is sealed up and has been sealed up for a very long time, and then you introduce something into it, you may introduce, modern gases, modern atmosphere, which if there's very fragile materials in there, say papyrus, documents, that type of thing, it could damage them very, very quickly by being exposed to the modern atmosphere if it's been sealed up.
Boy, that presents an enormous problem, doesn't
exactly,
it?
Exactly. So I can understand why, Egyptian authorities don't always want to rush into things. The other question is, well, how did they get into this chamber originally? I have not found, there must be some kind of entrance to it, and I've not found that, although I personally have a hypothesis as to the answer.
What's that?
And that is something else that we found. I'll try to describe it for those that have not been to Egypt. The Sphinx sits on the eastern edge of the Giza Plateau, to the east of the Second Pyramid. In front of the Sphinx is what's known as the Sphinx Temple. It's very ruinous now, but what we'll call the Sphinx Temple. And then in front of that, so you're headed west to east, so you have the Sphinx Temple, and then in front of the Sphinx Temple at the moment is just a big area of sand, basically. It's just level sand, and in fact, it's used for tourists to. It's a nice viewing platform, a nice place to look and see the Sphinx and the pyramids behind.
Yeah.
No one ever knew what was under the sand there. It was assumed it was just a layer of sand and, basically horizontal rock underneath. We did some seismic lines along there to see what was really under the sand. I was actually looking for the water table.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to see how low the water table was. Turns out that sand is really deep. And what we found is that the Sphinx and the Sphinx Temple in front of it basically sit on a cliff, if you would, if you removed all the sand. And I think originally that was probably not filled in with sand. We found what looked like some artificial or man-made structures at the base of the cliff. And I think originally you sort of approached the Giza Plateau walking west, so you're facing, looking at the Sphinx. You would see the Sphinx Temple and the Sphinx, and then looming behind it, ultimately in the Fourth Dynasty, the pyramids. And my suspicion is that there might be some kind of entrance on that cliff face that then goes into a corridor, or if you want to call it a tunnel, that would then go up into that chamber. But it's all covered with sand now. 50 feet of sand.
I was going to say, how high is that cliff? 50 feet?
Yeah, something like that.
Where did that sand just blow in from the desert, or do you think it was put there?
You have to remember, you're on the edge of the Sahara Desert, and there's lots of sand, and it blows in. It basically covers over and fills in everything.
Does it blow west to east mostly?
Mostly at the present day.
Yeah.
It blows down into essentially toward the east, toward the Nile Valley. Just tying in with that, the Sphinx itself, if you haven't been to Egypt, if one has not been to Egypt, a lot of times people think, well, the Sphinx just sits out there in its full glory. In fact, it sits in a hole.
I have not been there, and I'm dying to go. It's a place I've wanted to go since I was about 7 years old.
Oh, it's fabulous. I would recommend it to anyone. But it sits in a hole, or what's known as the Sphinx enclosure, or the Sphinx pit, sometimes people refer to it. And it's actually very logical if you think about it. It's carved from the bedrock. It's carved from natural stone.
Yeah.
And the head originally was a geological, I'll call it an outlier, seems to have sat above the ground level. And I think what they did originally is there was this big chunk of rock sitting above ground level. They started carving into a head. But then to carve the body, they had to carve down, if that makes sense. So, in fact, the body actually sits below what was the original ground level. And to this day, it basically looks like it sits in a hole, which is what it's doing.
I'll be darned.
Yeah, and that will fill up with sand very, very quickly if it's not attended to. I mean, within 10 to 20 years, if no one sweeps out the sand on a regular basis. And in fact, we know in ancient times, say, New Kingdom times, 1500, 1400 BC, the Sphinx was buried up to its chin in sand. And then
I've seen speculation about that. And
yeah.
Wouldn't that have preserved the body, though?
That is one very nice thing for me as a geologist. In fact, it did preserve the body. And that's one reason very, very ancient erosional features that go back to before 3000 BC are
mm-hmm.
still preserved on the body of the Sphinx. And
I see what you mean.
Yeah, use and date them. Put crudely, if the Sphinx had been originally carved, as was generally believed by traditional Egyptologists in 2500 BC, given how often it's been filled in with sand and covered over with sand,
mm-hmm.
It would have nowhere close to the erosion that we see on the body of the Sphinx. Much of that is very, very ancient weathering and erosion that's been preserved.
Have you... You know, your theory about that it was wetter and more water in that area, whether it was surface water or underground water,
mm-hmm.
rain or jungle or what? I mean, have you confirmed that?
I'm sorry?
Have you confirmed that
theory? Oh, yeah, actually,
that's
not my theory.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to take credit for that. And when I say we know, geologists have reconstructed over the last... 80 to 100 or more years, very detailed patterns of climate and weather in North Africa. And that's very well known, that it was much wetter, more temperate, sort of lush savanna-type area, not just in Giza, but all through North Africa. We have all kinds of evidence for that from actual fossil, I would call them subfossil, but ancient
mm-hmm.
organisms. Some people may have heard about paintings that have been found going back to 4000 BC and earlier that actually show what it looked like. I mean, the inhabitants were making paintings, these ancient paintings of what it looked like. We have soil samples that include things like pollens, tells you exactly what plants were living there, which of course correlates with the climate, with the amount of rainfall. So that's
mm-hmm.
very well established.
Just out of curiosity, where are these ancient paintings?
Oh, some of them are found in the parts of the Western Sahara. Some are actually found to the east.
Are they in buildings they find them, or on buildings?
No, sort of on, if you think, I mean, the best analogy that most people would know is if you think about Australia, how they'll have paintings on cliff faces and,
I've seen rocks,
that type of thing. You get that
right.
In, say, before 4000 BC or so in ancient Egypt also in certain places. So some of that is just a matter of, where do you have a cliff face or a little rock shelter where they've been preserved ever since. I mean, there must have been many more that have been lost.
Wow. You mentioned also this cavern or this cavity under the paw of the Sphinx. But you also said that there's a tunnel under the whole thing. Now, are you saying it's not part of the Sphinx, but it's below it?
Yeah, below it. Below it. And then that ties in with the, if you think of the Sphinx, it's carved out of bedrock. And these features, as far as I can determine, are actually under the Sphinx, not within the body of the Sphinx.
And what are the dimensions of that? Could you calculate that?
That tunnel type feature?
Yeah. I mean, is it like tall enough to walk in and really wide or what?
We have exactly. I suspect it's probably. It's. I don't know if it would be big enough. I'm a little over 6 feet for me to actually walk in standing
mm-hmm.
up, but I think I could. I could certainly maneuver through it. And it seems to be about the length of the body, and the Sphinx itself is about 240 or so feet long, and it seems to run the length of the body underneath the body. Length of the body. When it shows up, it looks like it may be wider, sort of widens and narrows along its length.
Yeah.
Not precisely. Again, that's based on the seismic data we've got so far. not precisely the same width all along its length.
Do you find rubble in that, too, as you found in the cavity?
Yes, it looks like. In fact, one reason I'm a little, I say it looks like it may sort of widen in places and narrow in places, it may be that it's collapsed a little bit. So that's why it's showing up that way. If it's a human-made feature that was perfectly smooth dimensions along its length originally and then collapsed in a couple of places.
That could happen.
It would look like what we see, on the seismic data.
We're going to find out more because we're talking about the Sphinx. We haven't even gotten to the pyramids yet, and boy, that takes us all around the world. Where'd they come from? Why? Who did it? How? All of that we'll touch on right here on Coast to Coast AM as we continue. I'm Barbara Simpson.
Coast to Coast AM with Barbara Simpson.
This morning, Dr. Robert Schock, a scientist who has studied the Sphinx in Egypt and made some astounding discoveries. And that led him to look further at the pyramids, and my oh my, what he found. We'll continue on Coast to Coast AM. I'm Barbara Simpson. Talking with Dr. Robert M. Schock, who is a tenured associate professor of science and mathematics at Boston University and one of the world's preeminent geologists. And he was telling us about the work he did studying the Sphinx and finding a cavern, something in the paw of the Sphinx, as well as a tunnel beneath it, as well as the fact that it appears that there was that it sits on the top of a cliff, which is no longer a cliff because it's filled with sand, just raising all kinds of mysteries. And probably the biggest of all of this is the age of it. Dr. Schock, how old do you figure the Sphinx is?
Well, by my calculations, based on the geological data, it's at least the earliest portions are at least 5,000 BC. My best estimate is 5 to 7,000 BC for the oldest portion, although I have to admit that the data, I tend to be conservative. The data does allow it to be a bit older than that even.
But that's even more shocking.
Yeah, exactly. At least 5 to 7,000 BC.
In light of that, isn't that before we thought there were people living there?
Yes, exactly. At least cultured, civilized people that would have been building things like sphinxes. And initially, the way I dealt with this, I remember giving talks back in the early 90s when I was first developing this data and first talking about it publicly at things like Geological Society of America meeting or American Association for the Advancement of Society. American Association for the Advancement of Science, I want to say.
Science, right.
Science, not society.
Right.
For science. And I would be asked the question in some cases by particularly critics, and they thought this was the question that was going to get me. And the question was something to the effect of, well, if the Sphinx is so much older, who built the Sphinx? Who carved
exactly.
The Sphinx? And my answer, very simply, and this was genuine, I wasn't trying to be evasive, was I'm a geologist. I can tell you how old it is. I can talk about the geology and the results of my study, but it's not my domain to tell you who built it. And, you know, that's your problem, not my problem. And I was being very genuine. I wasn't trying to be just dismissive. And in part it says something, that little anecdote I think says something about how, you know, different people from different backgrounds can think about things.
Mm-hmm.
But the honest truth is, if I start thinking about, well, someone must have built it, who were they? They weren't, it wasn't the dynastic Egyptians. Dogma of the time said that there were no civilized people that would have been able to do this. When I say civilized, I use it in a general term. To carve the Sphinx, even the earliest forms of the Sphinx, you need manpower. You need to have organizational levels beyond what we believed was the case that long ago, at least believed, 20 years ago, what people believed was the case 4,000, 5,000, 6,000 BC.
Sure. But you also need tools.
You also need tools, and this becomes interesting because it's not just a matter of chipping away the rock and carving the body of the Sphinx. When they carved the Sphinx, they actually took out huge blocks and they reassembled those in front of the Sphinx as the structure that I mentioned earlier, the Sphinx Temple. So they were doing some real monumental stonework. Not only carving the Sphinx, but building this temple in front of it. So it's actually quite sophisticated. And the fact that it goes back so much earlier than previously believed really does say something important about the origins of civilization, how far back civilization in that part of the world goes. Now, since my initial work on the Sphinx, more data has been coming to light. I want to mention one quick thing, and that's Nabta Playa. I don't know if you or some of the listeners are familiar with that, but it's in southern Egypt, has been really discovered and publicized since my initial work on the Sphinx, and sometimes it's referred to as Egypt Stonehenge. But what was found is a series of aligned megalithic stones forming what some people refer to as a calendar circle. And it's got all kinds of interesting astronomical alignments, solar, lunar, stellar alignments, and incredibly sophisticated, and goes back to at least 4,500 BC, maybe in the range 4,500 to 8,000 BC or earlier. And again, indicates a level of sophistication not previously suspected by most people at a very early age.
And what was the name of it again?
Nabta.
Nabta.
Yeah, Nabta Playa, N-A-B-T-A. And I talked about this a little bit in Voyages of the Pyramid Builders. So all these things are coming to light now, and I think it's not coincidental in my mind that Nabta and these stone calendars are the same time period I'm talking about for the early Sphinx. So I think we've vastly underestimated the level of sophistication of ancient people, not just in Egypt, but around the world. And we've underestimated how early they were doing incredible feats.
The stone of the Sphinx is natural stone to that area,
it's
right?
It's natural stone. It's limestone.
It's
the same stone. That stone has been sitting there for about 40 million years.
Ah, okay. Now, what about the stones of this Nabta Playa?
They are basically various sandstones, and they are from the general region. When I say the general region, they're from the region.
Mm-hmm.
They moved them around. In some cases, they may have moved them a mile or two, dragged them around and raised them. So, I mean, when you're talking, they're not huge. But, you know,
how huge?
9 to 12 foot stones weighing many, many tons. I mean, it's not an inconsiderable undertaking. it wasn't just one person walking around picking them up and
propping them up.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. I mean, it obviously took a concerted effort, but what's really more interesting about that site is not the moving of the stones, but the sophistication of how they are aligned relative to astronomical positions.
How, in terms of time, how do those stones relate to other stone circles around the world, Stonehenge being one of them?
It's apparently the earliest.
The earliest of all of them, huh?
Yeah, the earliest of all of them. The beginnings of Stonehenge go back a bit, maybe a bit before 3000 BC. Classic Stonehenge is a bit later. The actual stones of Stonehenge, most people would date a bit later. Third millennium, you know, maybe 2600 or so BC.
Mm-hmm.
So, this seems to be one of the earliest, if probably the earliest.
Did the technology or the knowledge or the culture or the civilization that built the Sphinx, what relation did that have to the building of the earliest pyramids?
That's a very good question, and it's not something that I think anyone understands fully at this point. The pyramids, the earliest pyramids that we know of, are not found in Egypt. They are actually found, and the dating is a little difficult. They're found in Peru, going back well before 3000 BC. There's some pyramid-type structures in northern China that seem to date from about the same period. Now, going back to the Giza Plateau, the pyramids that are on the plateau now, as we know them, the traditional date is around maybe 2550 to 2480 BC, so about 2500 BC in rough terms.
Mm-hmm.
But and then you've got the Sphinx, as I said, that goes back to at least 5000 BC, 5 to 7000 BC. Now, something that I've been doing and a couple of other people independently have been working on in the last few years, one by the name of Colin Reeder, in particular a British geologist, is looking and rethinking the whole Giza Plateau situation. The pyramids, at this point, I don't doubt that the superstructures of the pyramids, or I'm not questioning heavily whether the superstructures, the actual pyramids we see on the Giza Plateau, are 4th Dynasty. They could well be 4th Dynasty. But I think they sit on the sites of earlier structures. Maybe those were, we could call them proto-pyramids. We're not sure exactly what they were. And they seem to be seen on earlier sites, which were then rebuilt. And when I say the modern, the 2500 BC pyramids were built on top of. So what was there with the Sphinx originally is still somewhat questionable.
Would it be possible? I mean, you were talking about the fact that the Sphinx was originally on at the top of a cliff.
Right.
And that cliff, the face of the cliff is now filled with sand, so it looks like it's level. Is it possible that the original structures predating the current pyramids could still be there, but they're under them? I mean,
yeah,
could they have built them literally on top?
No, literally on top. My analysis of the second pyramid, in particular the so-called Khafre pyramid, which in fact, interestingly, the ancient Egyptians referred to as the Great Pyramid. The pyramid they referred to as the Great Pyramid is not the one that moderns refer to as the Great Pyramid. The Great Pyramid is the modern term, Great Pyramid, and the second pyramid are almost the same size. The Great Pyramid is actually a bit larger, which is why modern people refer to it as the Great Pyramid. But in fact, the second pyramid, based on my analysis, I think that the base of it is not the same as the rest of the superstructure, and it's just what you were saying. I believe that, in fact, in the base of it, we have an older structure that was then built upon by the dynastic Egyptians. And very interestingly, people, if you go to the Giza Plateau, look at the second pyramid closely, you'll see that there is a band of granite around the base. That's not indigenous to the Giza Plateau. That was brought up from Aswan, brought down the Nile from Africa.
What does that signify?
And what that signifies to me is that this is showing that this is a rebuilt structure. This is a refurbished or renewed structure. Granted, and this is not, I'm not just saying this, I mean, this is known among Egyptologists who I've spoken with. Granite was often, it was sometimes used originally, admittedly, but it was often used as a marker, if you would, or was used to indicate that something was being renewed or refurbished or reformed. And there's a very long tradition, not just in Egypt, but wherever you have pyramids, of many pyramids being they were living monuments in their time, and they were being used and reused, and they would be refurbished and rebuilt upon. And I think that's exactly what you have with the second pyramid. So even if what we're looking at now is about 2500 BC, it's very clear in my mind that the origins go back much earlier.
Now, if you wanted to investigate what's under there, how would you do that?
With great difficulty. No, because you can't just drill into it. You can't just, I mean, you're talking, that's one thing about pyramids in general. Pyramids are structures that are primarily massive.
Yeah.
Stone are massive substance. They're not buildings that have a lot of interior space to them. So mostly you have to use remote means, like I was talking about the seismic studies that we did around the Sphinx. You could maybe apply something like that to the pyramids. You have to be careful, though. I mean, other people have tried various types of remote sensing, radar and whatnot, and you have to be careful that you're not being deceived, because as you've got rock piled upon rock and different types of rock layers, sometimes it can give you anomalous results when nothing's really there.
Could you see something from space?
The more and more sophisticated some of the satellite imagery gets, you might be able to. My guess is that you're going to get your best images. Your most useful images are probably military and classified at the moment. Yeah, possibly. I mean, something that's been very, very useful is high altitude images, satellite images that sometimes will show up. For instance, patterns of buildings and structures that you can't see from the surface.
Right. That's what I was thinking of, that they might be able to at the very least, I would think, determine the outline of something.
Exactly, if there's something around it. Now that would be limited, though, if the current pyramid is built absolutely on top of an older structure.
Oh, well, that's true.
Yeah. So, but often, you know, be offset a little bit, that type of thing. Mm-hmm. In fact, one thing that we have, again, second pyramid, Khafre, commonly known as the Khafre pyramid after the pharaoh Khafre from the 4th dynasty, is a structure known as the mortuary temple, which sits right on the east face of that pyramid. Traditional date for this structure, again, is 4th dynasty, about 2500 BC. What I've determined, and another geologist, Colin Reeder, has also determined independently, is this structure is actually a two-part structure. It's got an older portion, which dates back before 4th dynasty. And then it was that older portion was built upon and incorporated into the 4th dynasty temple. So again, example of use and reuse, and that there was there were things going on much earlier than previously suspected.
Have you figured out in your studies of the Egyptian pyramids or some of the other ones, I'm thinking mainly of the ones in Central America and South America, how they did it?
No, that I'll tell you, that continues to be a real issue, and something that I've not really addressed so far in Voyages, well, in the current book, Voyages of the Pyramid Builders. Mm-hmm. I really try to address more the timing, the influence between them, not the engineering feat, which is an amazing feat of how they were built. And to this day, I'm convinced that no one really knows how they did it. There have been many theories as to how they moved these massive blocks. And the problem is not just moving one or two blocks, but doing it consistently over a period of time and within a reasonable period of time to actually build the structures.
You said that the pyramids were used and reused. What did they use them for?
That it depends on what culture you're talking about. So if you're talking about Egypt, there were more monuments in the sense of monuments to be viewed, really to be viewed from a distance, symbolic monuments. People to this day argue whether, you know, how important they were as far as tombs or you know, places of burial for pharaohs. I'm not going to discount that, but I personally don't think that was the main source, the main inspiration, the main function. It's sort of like taking a Gothic cathedral and saying, well, the main function of the cathedral was to bury some people that, you know, we find the graves there.
Yeah.
But, yeah, sure, it was used for that purpose.
But there were other purposes that
superseded
that.
Yeah, I think it was more other purposes of memorializing and explaining, you know, man's position in relation to the cosmos.
Right, and certainly the question of those darn little tunnels that they've been exploring, too. We'll continue our discussion of the pyramids, which is not limited to Egypt. My guest is Dr. Robert M. Schock. His book, Voyages of the Pyramid Builders. That'll give you a hint where we're going with this. I'm Barbara Simpson on Coast to Coast AM.
Somewhere out there. This is Coast to Coast AM with Barbara Simpson.
That's me, Barbara Simpson, with you on Coast to Coast AM, telling you about the official Coast to Coast AM newsletter. You know, it's not too late if you want to order a subscription and use it for a Valentine's gift. There's St. Patrick's Day coming up. There's probably birthdays, or you can get one just because you want one. You get a year's subscription, which normally means 12 issues, but you get 14 for the price of 12. It's the After Dark newsletter. It's $39.95 for the year. Two ways to get it. Subscribe online at coasttocoastam.com or use the toll-free phone number, 888-727-5505. It's $39.95 a year. You'll love every single issue. 888-727-5505. I'm Barbara Simpson. Talking with Dr. Robert Schock about pyramids. We were talking about the pyramids in Egypt, but as you mentioned, there are pyramids all around the world, and a number of them date older than the civilizations are supposed to be able to have constructed them. Give us an idea of some of the other areas as your research carried you in looking at pyramids in different places on different continents.
Yeah, well, pyramids are found basically on all continents except Antarctica and Australia. People tend to think of Egyptian pyramids when they think of pyramids. I think that's just a function of our culture and society.
Yeah.
More pyramids are actually found in Mexico and Mesoamerica more generally than, as far as we know, any other part of the world. In fact, many people are familiar with some of the Mesoamerican pyramids. And you have just as magnificent pyramids there. You get pyramids in South America, in the Peruvian Andes. You get pyramids, and it depends in part on how you define pyramid, but the way I define pyramid, you include things like parts of England and Ireland, Newgrange in Ireland, Silbury Hill in England, I think falls within the pyramid building tradition. In ancient times, many of them are gone now, but in ancient times you had pyramids throughout Mesopotamia and Sumeria. Very interestingly, you get them throughout India and Southeast Asia, and in particular in China. Many people are not aware of the pyramids in China because they're so poorly known, just because China has been such a closed and isolated society, both in the past, distant past and the very recent past. To this day, it's free travel in China is not always free and easy.
No,
and
you go where they want you to.
Exactly, and they do not, for whatever reason, they have not wanted to publicize their pyramids, but they in fact have incredible pyramids. I have in Voyages of the Pyramid Builders some photographs of some of the pyramids.
You have some amazing pictures in there. I mean, because there are examples of everything you're talking about. Now, another aspect of it are pyramids in North America.
Yes, North America, were sometimes known as the mounds or the mound builders. But in fact, they are pyramids. They are primarily earthwork pyramids, but they're right within the pyramid tradition that we find around the world.
Now, what's the age range of all of these? I mean, they don't all fall within the same group of centuries, do they?
No. In fact, pyramids around the world vary greatly in age, the pyramids that we know. And like we were talking about before, you have to remember that many pyramids that we see today are actually built on the sites of older pyramids.
Mm-hmm.
But they range from prior to 3000 B.C., for instance, in Peru and in China, what we know of some of the Chinese pyramids, all the way up to in Mesoamerica, they were still actively building pyramids in the 15th century A.D. when it was, quote, conquered by Europeans. So pyramid, and a lot of people don't realize this, pyramids and pyramid building traditions have spanned a continuous period for 4,500 to 5,000 years or more around the world. The vast majority of civilized time, or time since we've known of civilization, some culture somewhere has been building pyramids.
Is there either a mystical or a magical quality about that particular shape?
Well, this is something I discuss at length in the book. I would say, I don't know if I like the terms mystical and magical. I think it's rooted in real life. And I believe that pyramids have a lot of mythology surrounding them, a lot of common mythology and traditions around the world. They have to do with essentially the sky and what I refer to at one point in the book too, as sky religions, religions that reach up to the skies, that deal with the skies. Before the last break, you were starting to mention some of the little tunnels that we find, for instance, in Egyptian pyramids, and what's been found by the work of many different peoples. These have alignments with the sky. They're not just random little air shafts and tunnels, often referred to as air shafts, but they actually point to objects in the sky. You find solar and stellar alignments of pyramids all around the world. So this is one of the common themes, that they have something to do with the sky. And one thing that I talk about in both Voyages of the Pyramid Builders and actually my earlier book, Voices of the Rocks, is that I believe, and I'm not the only one with this belief, that there were things going on in the sky at certain periods in ancient times that we don't observe today. So there was a very, very real interest in what was happening in the sky. And in particular, I'm thinking in terms of cometary activity and activity in the sky that happens at certain periods in time that I believe had a real influence on pyramid building and other aspects of religion and society.
You know, I did mention the tunnels in the Egyptian pyramids. The thing that astounds me in terms of the construction is not only their ability to move and lift and place the huge stones that form the building, but that these little tiny passageways could be constructed within this mass. I mean,
exactly.
I'm not an engineer. I couldn't even begin to think,
right,
how the heck
right.
do you do that?
You know? Oh, yeah. In fact, I agree with you. I think some of the and not just the Egyptian pyramids, but pyramids around the world, some of the really amazing aspects are not so much just the pure massiveness and the huge size of the blocks in some cases, because, I mean, yeah, that's amazing that they could move the stuff. But I can personally visualize, well, you know, you have the time and energy and you move it a little bit by little bit. But the engineering feats of the alignments and getting those little passageways and little tunnels and shafts just oriented perfectly so they're pointing at what you want them to point to in the sky, I mean, it's amazing.
What was going on in the sky then that was different?
Well, what apparently, and this is based on both physical evidence, geological evidence, climatological evidence, mythological evidence, astrophysical evidence. Apparently what was happening is that at certain periods in time, the Earth's orbit intersects, and I'm oversimplifying to a certain extent, intersects the orbits of comets and cometary debris that orbits the sun.
Mm-hmm.
And we seem to go in and out of phases on approximately, in very crude terms, it's not exactly clockwork, but approximately 1,500 to 1,000-year cycle, we go in and out of cometary debris, the Earth's orbit. And this, in some cases, can have real effects on the surface of the Earth. Probably everything from seeing, you know, increased cometary activity in the sky, you know, in some cases, dazzling displays of comets. In the ancient literature, there are time periods when the ancients referred to two suns in the sky. One was probably a comet.
Mm-hmm.
In some cases, cometary fragments, we referred to them usually as meteorites, actually hit the surface, may have caused destruction and damage. A modern example of that is known as Tunguska
in
1906 in Russia, Siberia. Something came down and flattened just incredible expanse of forest. If it hit New York or Paris, everyone would know about it. Now, lots of people know about it, but lots of people don't know about it,
yeah.
Given that hidden remote region of Siberia. But more than that, you don't need fragments of comets coming down and actually hitting to cause major social disruption, major changes. Because if you get a lot of debris in the upper atmosphere, that will cause climate changes. And we can pick those up, and we have picked those up in things like Greenland ice cores and tree rings, dendrochronology. You can get a very good feel for climate. You can get a feel for the amount of dust that was in the atmosphere. And there were times of major changes and turmoil You have a couple of bad years weather-wise, and you can totally wipe out the crop, and this can cause mass famine and starvation. Be very unsettling. It could be very unsettling. Will be very unsettling to a modern society, much less an ancient society.
Of course, there are those theories as to why these various civilizations disappeared. I mean, I'm thinking now, you know, the Aztecs and the Mayans and,
right.
and some of the Native American cultures and certainly around the world. Do you suspect that, in fact, it was something like this that, that then had the after effect of famine? So they had to move because they needed to find food?
When you say after effect, I think as a geologist, it was basically a simultaneous effect. You have one bad year of crops,
mm-hmm.
and things are happening very quickly. You know, even to this day, I don't know how many people realize that. To this day, on a global basis, we are very dependent every year on, you know, having a good crop coming in. I mean, you know, if all of a sudden the plants died off, the world would starve very quickly.
You mean I just can't run to my supermarket and buy some more bread?
I'm afraid not. No, this is something I'm interested in other contexts. Here we are, sophisticated people with our computers and everything. We're still dependent upon the elements. And so it was certainly the same back then. And I think, getting back to what we were talking about almost 2 hours ago, I mean, in some sense, I think, how do I want to say this? They had more of a concept of their place and their dependence on nature and the cosmos and things that they couldn't really control. But the pyramids, tying in with the pyramids, is, in my opinion, had a lot to do with it. This sort of reaching to the heavens, at least trying to understand what was going on in some cases. I mean, we don't want to oversimplify it, but trying to restore order to the heavens. Essentially a sky religion.
Yeah,
which
I think
is the root of virtually all religion that we have nowadays.
Yeah, I think we tend to think that we have developed our civilization and that we have technology. And that we're in charge.
Exactly.
And the reality is, we're not.
We're not.
I mean, ultimately, we're not. You have one good blizzard, you have one good hurricane, you have one massive earthquake or
exactly.
tidal wave or God knows, you know, you've got a whole variety of catastrophes, and we're wiped out because if you get rid of electricity, we don't have anything.
Exactly, exactly. All your food spoils.
That's right. You don't have any water, you don't have any food, your house burns down.
Yeah. No, we are so dependent, and yet I think the average person in the street does not really realize that.
No. In terms of where these things came from, I'm still intrigued by the fact that the Sphinx is so much older and that this pyramid building has such a range of years. Who did it? Who were these people? And is it another case of what happened to them? I mean, is that a legitimate question to ask?
Oh, yeah, it's absolutely a legitimate question to ask. And it really depends on where you're looking. I mean, we're talking a global, if you would, in the broad sense, a global culture of pyramid building, not simultaneously around the world. And I think... And this is something I trace in Voyages of the Pyramid Builders. I think you can trace all this pyramid building back to a central origin that essentially spread throughout the world. And so it was earlier in some portions of the world, later in other portions of the world. The beginning, in my assessment, is not Egypt. That's one of the early side branches. The beginning is not Japan or Peru. That's one of the early side branches. And later side branches, if you would, go into Mesoamerica, Mexico in particular, into parts of India, So, you know, there's a diffusion. In fact, one thing I talk about to a great extent in the book is the concept of diffusion of culture and thoughts and ideas, society, pyramids being just one aspect of diffusion of culture around the world.
Yeah, but and where did it start?
Where it started, the conclusion I come to is that started in a place known as Sundaland. And when
Sundaland?
Sundaland.
Where's that?
And Sundaland is basically underwater now. It's between, essentially, between the Indonesian region, Borneo, Southeast Asia, Malaysia. If people know that region, it's now covered by the southern portion of the South China Sea.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a region, it's known as Sunda or Sundaland by geologists, very well known among geologists. It was a region essentially the size of a small continent that was buried with water at the end of the last ice age. And when I say the end of the last ice age, thinking as a geologist, relatively recently in the 6,000 to 4,000 BC period. Most people are familiar with the ice ages. A lot of water was locked up in glaciers as they melted. To make a long story shorter and simpler, sea levels rose.
Yes.
This was one region that apparently was a very lush area. It was above sea level then. It was covered with water. It was drowned. It's now covered with fairly shallow water. When I say shallow, a couple hundred feet. But that's deeper than you can live in.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of evidence points back to this region as being, I believe, the origin of pyramid building culture and civilization that then spread out as it was covered with water. I mean, they had to go somewhere.
So their land started to be covered.
Exactly.
And they left. But are there remnants of their civilization there? I mean, if Robert Ballard sent Alvin down there, could he take pictures of what's left?
Well, this has not been done yet. This has not been done yet. And even though it's relatively recent geologically, well, let me answer your question. My answer to your question is I believe, yes,
mm-hmm.
that you would find something down there. But you have to understand that even though we know the general area, to find specifics, you know, it's still finding the needle in the haystack, as they say. Even though a typical pyramid, if they were building, which I suspect they were, pyramids like the size of Egyptian pyramids or Mexican pyramids, I mean, good-sized structures.
Mm-hmm.
Still, to find that under a couple of hundred feet of water, 6,000 to 8,000 years later, with silt and sedimentation, etc., it's not going to be a simple task.
Well, but that's where the military satellite imaging would be golden.
Exactly. This is where classified imaging would probably do the best.
Oh, my. I mean, let's see that.
You think about finding, now, it was under much deeper water, the Titanic. But on the other hand, the Titanic, you know, went down only a century ago.
That's
and
true.
You know very specifically what you're looking for, you know, I don't want to say exactly where, but pretty much where to look for it, et cetera. And that was a major task to find. So, I mean, these are not easy tasks, and doing any kind of underwater archaeology is incredibly difficult.
These people, then, I want to pursue this with you when we come back, is who were they and where did they go? How did they get there? And then, of course, ultimately, I guess the question would be is, you know, where did they wind up and did they just disappear or do we have remnants of them or part of us today somewhere, which I guess is possible, but we'll find out more. My guest, Dr. Robert M. Schoch, S-C-H-O-C-H, and the website would be www.robertschoch.homestead.com. And again, the last name is S-C-H-O-C-K. The book, Voyages of the Pyramid Builders. I'm Barbara Simpson. Well,
It's time for the February edition.
Coast and worldwide on the internet. This is Coast to Coast AM with Barbara Simpson.
Morning, everybody. We're continuing with Coast to Coast AM. We're talking with Robert Schock about voyages of the pyramid builders. How did the idea of building pyramids spread around the world? And what about the fact that some of them were built long before, thousands of years before we even thought that civilizations existed? Who were those people? How did they travel around the world so long ago, and what happened to them? We have their buildings, but we don't have them. Or do we? We'll find out. I'm Barbara Simpson. This is Coast to Coast AM. Talking with Robert Schock about the things that he has investigated and discovered about the history of pyramids and the civilizations around them. Going back to as far back as you can go in your theory, how old was that civilization? And you said you thought it started specifically where?
Sunderland, which is, as we were talking about, a region basically between Indochina and Borneo and Malaysia, Indonesia, that region of the world, which is now most of it's buried by the South China Sea, and was buried between about, well, the final sea level rises were maybe between 6,000 and 4,000 BC. As far as when people were living there in the civilization in that buried area, we don't know how far back it went. Would have been at the end of the last ice age. May have gone back 15,000 BC or earlier.
Wow. Where would they have gone?
Well, that's what I think. I think they basically spread out over the world. I think they basically, as the water levels were rising, they took to whatever boats that they had, and some went east, some went, based on the evidence, basically west, northwest. I think we find inklings of them where we find pyramids initially. For instance, some going east, I think probably made it all the way to what we know as the New World, South America and Peru in particular, where we find some very early pyramids. Others, I think, the evidence indicates went essentially north to what is now China, parts of China where we find some very early pyramids. Others headed off more to the west through India and also around India and ultimately making it into the Mesopotamian region, which is the cradle, by standard traditional thinking, the cradle of civilization in Mesopotamia.
That's what we've been taught. That's
what
right.
We've always been taught, but it doesn't seem to be holding up after all. Ironically, you know, Mesopotamia, Iraq, modern Iraq, where we may have a war very soon, once again. Quite a shame. And from there, but I think that was really a secondary arising of civilization, spurred on by the migration of the Sunderlanders. Same with Egypt. Probably a secondary
But are the people who live in those places now, are you... Would that indicate that they are descendants of these Sunderlanders?
Because
everybody looks different.
China,
you're talking India, you're talking South America, and Europe. I mean, you've got all the different races.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that the answer, there's not an easy answer, there's not a simple answer to the question you're asking, and it's a very legitimate question. And all the evidence, that, as I see it, indicates that these regions I'm talking about had indigenous populations.
Ah.
So they had indigenous populations To oversimplify, the Sundalanders made it to these regions, basically intermarried, if you would, intermixed, brought aspects of their culture to the indigenous population, just as they brought some of their genes, genetic material to the indigenous population. And what we find is now a mixture, both genetically and culturally, of both what would have been the indigenous population and which would have been, in terms of numbers, the greater number, and the we'll call them Sunderlanders, these migrants who were diffusing what I think was really the origins or spurring of high culture and civilization. For instance, there's evidence from Thailand at this point, because of course most of Sunderland is now underwater, but that there was very early bronze making and copper working, very early metallurgy in that region of the world, earlier than is known elsewhere anywhere in the world. So this seems to have been the origin of metallurgy. Same with agriculture. Now it appears that agriculture originated in that region of the world earlier than anywhere else. And I think these were cultural traits that then diffused out and were brought to indigenous populations elsewhere in the world.
Did those new peoples resulting from the intermarriage, et cetera, did they die out somewhere along the line and then new peoples came in? Or are the people in all of these places around the world simply descendants of them?
Well, something that's very interesting is that when you look at genetic evidence, there's amazing commonalities among all people of the world to this day. Underlying, we've sort of got this commonality, and then we've got the superficial differences among us. So I think in answer to your question, the Sundalanders are still in us today from different regions.
I have to ask you, how does that fit with the theory that we're all descendants from one black woman in Africa?
It's not incompatible, because the theory that we're all descendants from one black woman or a very small group of people in Africa, that's talking about an earlier period, more in the 100 to 150,000 year range.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, it's very, very compatible that the human population has undergone several periods of crisis, should we say, where much of the human population we'll use the term was exterminated around the world, except for a small subgroup, which then repopulated, if you would, the world.
Mm-hmm. I mean, what killed them off?
I think it probably goes back to natural catastrophes that we were talking about in an earlier segment of the show. I mean, that, you know, you can have a climatic change, for instance, that just can wreak real havoc on populations. I mean, we're still subject to those types of features to this day, even though we don't seem to realize it in our hubris. But back then, you know, it's almost a bad roll of the dice.
If you would.
Now, ultimately, based on my geological analysis, and you know, as a physical scientist, I think a lot of these features go back to things in the sky, you know, astronomical phenomena.
They're talking about that now, Doctor. I mean, there are proposals now that we have to develop some type of device that, as we see the asteroid coming in, that we can blow it out of orbit so it doesn't crash into the Earth.
And a lot of that's pretty crazy, too, because this is just a side comment. Some of that is so, in my opinion, overly simplistic. If you have an asteroid coming and you see it 3 days before it hits, you're not going to blow it out of orbit. If you blow it up, instead of one big chunk coming down, you've got a lot of small pieces coming down, which could, you know, be even more dangerous than one big piece. One big piece might, you know, knock out a good region of the world. A lot of small pieces, you sort of ensure that everyone dies.
Everybody dies equally.
Yeah.
One point that you sort of infer is how the people traveled. This would necessitate them crossing the oceans. Now, obviously, at that time, the oceans were not necessarily in the size or the place that we know them today, but they still had bodies of water they had to cross.
Yeah, I mean, we're not talking, just to clarify, we're not talking that geologically that remote a period. For all practical purposes, we can think of the oceans today as the oceans at the period we're talking.
Oh, okay.
So they're considerable bodies of water, considerable sizes. And, yeah, this is a major theme in Voyages of the Pyramid Builders about, I believe, and I'm not alone in this belief, that all the evidence indicates that in ancient times, and we've been talking about how people were more sophisticated earlier, in ancient times, they were quite capable of traveling across the oceans, navigating across the oceans. And I think that was occurring on a regular basis. And I don't think they were just doing this for fun. It was necessity when climate changed, when sea levels rose in particular. And I think it started with Sunderland, where you've got your home. It's all of a sudden covered with water. You've got to go somewhere if you're not going to die. And the evidence is very clear in my mind. And I talk about this for a couple of chapters in Voyages, that they had the ability to cross oceans, to undergo transoceanic travel, and we've got good evidence that they were doing that. I think it's sort of a modern myth, and when I say modern, the last 500 years, that no one could cross the oceans until Columbus did it in 1492. That's to put simply,
not so, huh?
That's nonsense.
How would they have done it? What are you talking about? I remember Thor Heyerdahl with
Kon-Tiki
and Ra. I mean, that type of craft?
Yeah, there were two basic types of crafts, as I've been able to reconstruct it, and again, I talk about this in Voyages. There were two basic types of crafts, I believe, that they were using. One was reed boats, and those were... This is, again, a little bit oversimplifying for purpose of discussion now, but reed boats being used across the Atlantic, and in fact, we find reed boats on both sides of the Atlantic of incredible similarity. You really can't tell them apart. You get them in South America in particular, and, of course, in Egypt and Mesopotamia. If people are familiar with... various reliefs in Egypt and Mesopotamia, beautiful reed boats are shown, and you get exactly the same thing in South America. I don't think that's coincidental. I think it's because they were crossing. And the great late Thor Heyerdahl, demonstrated with the Ra and the Ra II that you can cross the Atlantic with a reed boat. So I think it was primarily reed boats, which are incredibly durable, seaworthy boats, were being used in ancient times across the Atlantic. Across the Pacific, there's a great tradition of rafts. And rafts have a bad connotation, I think, for most Americans. They think of these little rickety things that are, you know, can barely float. But that's not what we're talking about. We're really talking about these huge rafts that were very, very seaworthy, could carry enormous numbers of people and cargo. Again, you get very similar rafts on both sides of the Pacific, both in China and Asia more generally, and in South America and Mesoamerica. And these were definitely seaworthy ships. And,
when you say huge, what are you talking about? How huge is huge?
In some cases, to give you an example, when the 15th, early 16th century Spanish explorers first got to Peru and that region of the New World, they met some of the people, not on land, but by sea. And they were on these huge rafts that they described in Spanish terms as being clearly capable of carrying 50 people on horseback.
Good grief.
Exactly. Plus cargo to sustain them. So, I mean, we're talking major structures. And we're not just talking flat raft. They had superstructures. They had cabins on them. They had sails, et cetera. And something about both the rafts in the Pacific and the reed boats in the Atlantic is that these are types of vessels, even if you have a big swell or wave washing up on them, it washes through them. So they don't sink. It's not like the European boats of the time that they fill with water, they sink.
Right.
You know, so they were really a very different technology. And then you combine that with what we understand of their navigational abilities and their advanced astronomy, their ability to tell where they were and where they were going, plus the physical evidence. And they were migrating, they were moving across the oceans at will.
And moving across the world and trading, do you think, at that time, too?
I believe trading. I believe there was trade. I don't think that was the main driving force. I really think the driving force, I don't think, just to clarify, I don't think they were going back and forth across the oceans on a regular basis necessarily for trading. I think it was more a function that when there were these times of crisis, climatic crisis, cometary crisis, what they would see as natural and we would see as natural disasters, they had the ability and they used that ability to move to look for basically a better place to live, a better place to go. That certainly there was some trade, I believe. And also, in some cases, you know, they were just out fishing or doing whatever they wanted to do. And in some cases, there was probably some sporadic contact, just like today, where people got blown off course.
Sure. What was the because the Earth was younger at that time, was there more of this sky activity and more Earth change than there has been in the last, say, 3,000 years, so that we have been more stable in those last 2,000 or 3,000 years?
No, I actually think that it's not so much a function of that. It's really that we've been in somewhat of a quiescent period for the last roughly 800 to 1,000 years.
Mm-hmm.
And
I was afraid you were going to say that.
Yeah, and really what it is that it's only in the last 500 to 800 years that modern society has arisen, you know, the age of exploration. It's only in the last 100 years that, you know, modern electronics and flying and all that type of stuff has arisen. So we tend to extrapolate from the last couple of 100 years to the last maybe 500 or 800 years, and we assume that's the way the world has always been and always will be, and it's not true whatsoever. The last major period of turmoil, I'll use that term, turmoil in the skies, was the 12th century AD, so relatively recently.
And what happened then?
Oh, there was incredible cometary activity. This is recorded both in Europe and China and elsewhere in the world. In fact, starting in really the 10th, 11th century AD, in part it spurred on things like the Crusades. I mean, there's clear literary evidence that they saw something happening in the skies in Europe.
Mm-hmm.
And that, you know, they thought was the wrath of God or whatever, so they would go, you know, restore the Holy Land. But in fact, in the 12th century AD, most of the activity from an Earth perspective was not in Europe and the West, so that's influenced our view, but much of it was in the Pacific basin, the Pacific region.
And what happened there?
So along there, apparently you had incredible cometary activity. There must have been, by my understanding of the evidence, in some cases actual debris hitting the surface. You have tsunamis recorded. You have major climate changes. You have dynastic changes in China, for instance.
major change in the Song Dynasty. On Asia, there's just turmoil and famine. This allowed the Mongolians to actually take advantage of the situation, should we say. Upswing. In North and South America, you have end of certain cultures, major migrations, rise of other cultures. This is actually the beginning, earliest beginning of what would become the Aztec culture, which all of a sudden decided to move from the coast inland, I think because of, you know, major climate changes and rising oceans and tsunamis, that type of thing. In Australia and New Zealand, you have major changes. You have stories that all these that there was fire coming down from the sky, and a lot of animals were burnt to death. And this was always considered just mythology. So we start finding real geological evidence that about 1200 AD, this really happened.
We'll talk more with our guest, Robert Schock. It's a shock, isn't it? I'm Barbara Simpson. This is Coast to Coast AM.
Premier Radio Networks presents Coast to Coast AM with Barbara Simpson.
This is Barbara, and I want to tell you about the After Dark newsletter, the official Coast to Coast AM newsletter, a monthly little magazine that you will get in the mail. And when you order a year's subscription, actually you're going to get 14 issues. So it's 14 for the price of 12. It's a good deal. It's $39.95 a year. And every month you're going to get a copy of this. It's beautiful little magazine, slick paper, full color, editorial by George, quickening news update, and lots of wonderful articles. The one that's out now, the February edition, has a great interview of me, give you an idea of my thoughts on Coast and some of the other things I've done. I hope you enjoy it. A color, beautiful color cover that gets your interest peaked about electronic voice phenomenon, EVP, and lots more. Two ways to get it. Subscribe online at coasttocoastam.com, $39.95 a year, or you can call toll-free and order that way, 888-727-5505. That's 888-727-5505. I'm Barbara Simpson. Talking with my guest, Dr. Robert Schock. Doctor, you mentioned earlier that the only place in the world, or two places in the world, that pyramids are not found are Antarctica and Australia. Why do you think that's the case? I mean, how did they miss Australia? Antarctica, I could see, because it's, you know, if it's cold down there, you can see why they didn't go there.
Exactly, yeah. How did they miss Australia? Especially since it's so close to Sunderland. And I don't have any real good explanation for that at this point. What seems to be the case, I mean, this is what I would suggest, is that they seem to have migrated out both toward the east, northeast, toward the west, northwest. They seem to have been going north and easterly and westerly. For whatever reason, they seem not to have headed due south, which is you know, the way they'd have to go to hit Australia. May have had, I'm only speculating here, but may have had to do with weather patterns, currents, that type of thing at the time. You know.
Is there anything in the culture of the Aborigines in Australia, or perhaps even the Maoris in New Zealand, which would tie in with any of the things you're talking about historically? I know that the Aborigines have a great tradition of what they call dreamland, of what was before, and it's very extensive, and there are a lot of characters in there, I mean, figures, birds, and animals and things, and I just wonder, is there any tie-in that you know?
I think there are some tie-ins, and actually this may be the second part of the answer to your question, or suggestion to the answer. They do seem to have some culture and, I should say, mythology in common, especially stellar mythology as far as things like the Pleiades, the Seven Sisters, as they're often referred to, that the Australians recognize, just like many other cultures in the world, mm-hmm. which I think goes back to Sunderland. As far as actual pyramids, one reason we may, and I'm only speculating here, we may not have pyramids in Australia. First, I think there was not as strong a Sunderland influence, at least the evidence right now, that I have in Australia's other regions. And secondly, you do have in Australia some stone outliers, I would call them, geologically, that essentially are natural pyramids.
You're talking about Ayers Rock?
Yeah, things like Ayers Rock. And, you know, so maybe that substitute, if you would, for artificial pyramids. I mean, you certainly have mountains and whatnot in other parts of the world, but in Australia, for whatever reason, it may be that, especially, you know, they're so magnificent and so isolated, should we say, like classic artificially built pyramids. Again, I'm only speculating.
Sure.
It may also be the... I honestly don't hold enough hope out that we're going to discover pyramids in Australia at this point. I think it's been fairly well covered. But you never know what might...
Maybe it's one of those things, like you found, that would be buried. You know?
Yeah, exactly. You never know. Now, one thing that's very, and I mentioned in Voyages of the Pyramid Builders, is, and I don't want to make a big deal out of it because I don't know... I have my questions about the authenticity, but there are... were reported to be Egyptian hieroglyphic inscriptions in Australia. I mean, we're talking now a later period.
Mm-hmm.
But it, obviously, if they're authentic, it means the Egyptians got to Australia.
Well, they have a lot of the paintings, the cave paintings and wall paintings that the Aborigines did. Now, you're saying that possibly there's some of the hieroglyphics
There's a region... I think it's called Gosford in Australia, where there are clear Egyptian hieroglyphic inscriptions.
Mm-hmm.
The question is whether they're authentic ancient inscriptions or whether it's essentially a 100-year-old hoax.
I see what you mean. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's what I'm referring to there very specifically. But my point is right now that classically many traditional scholars would simply say it has to be a hoax, not on the basis of examining the evidence firsthand, but because, you know, the classic dogma is before the time of Columbus, people could not travel across oceans.
So therefore, happen.
It can't happen.
Yeah.
Tying in with that, and I don't exaggerate here, I remember decades ago now, a freshman student in an anthropology course. I was in an anthropology course, and we were told very, very bluntly that a wonderful laboratory to understand and explore civilization was comparing the civilizations of the quote New World, North and South America, to those of the Old World, because obviously they rose absolutely independently of each other and there was never any contact between the two. Why? It's obvious, because oceans separate them and no one could cross oceans before Columbus. I mean, that was my point is that was simply the accepted dogma.
Well, I was taught that.
Yeah.
You know, so,
and,
I mean...
For many people, it still is a dogma.
Yeah,
But as I try to outline in my book, I believe, just plenty of evidence to indicate otherwise.
Well, you have the terrible situation of the discovery of the Kennewick man up
right.
in Washington, where, I mean, if in fact he was what they thought he was, it would change the whole concept of migration of peoples in North
right.
America. And so to handle it, they simply tried to destroy it.
Right, exactly.
You know, which I think is tragic.
Oh, it's very tragic. But, you know, even if we don't have, I mean, even if they, which they hadn't, have not been able to do. I mean, even if it had been destroyed, in fact, Kennewick Man is not the only evidence for things happening other than what dogma has said.
Yeah.
For instance, I don't, well, as a side issue, and now we're going back 13, 14, 15,000 years, the original peopling of North America, the traditional dogma, if you would, which I certainly learned as an undergraduate many years ago, was that they came over Beringia, the Bering Land Bridge.
Right.
At the end of the Ice Age, they came from Mongolia and Siberia. And that was that. They came down and they became the Paleo Indians, which became the indigenous American population, and there was no influence from anywhere else at any other time. And that's simply not the case. First off, just very quickly, first off, all the evidence is they came much earlier, like, you know, tens of thousands of years earlier. And secondly, there is now clear evidence that some of them were not just coming from Asia, Mongolia, and Siberia, but some were coming from Europe, even as early as, say, 15, 13,000 years ago.
Hmm. Wasn't there also, oh, yeah, I just remembered, that I read about a mummy that was found in China,
mm-hmm.
or one of several, that
yeah.
had white skin and red hair.
Absolutely, absolutely. These have now been found in China and Mongolian region of China,
mm-hmm.
northern China, and they're basically a common term for them, or you know, we might call them colloquial Celts or Celts, Celtic.
Mm-hmm.
They're Europeans, and they've got not just fair skin and red hair, some of them, but they've got typical European fabrics and clothing, and yet they go back to 1000 BC or earlier. So, I mean, there was incredible intermixing and interchange in ancient times that we're only beginning to become aware of, and is absolutely against, you know, standard traditional dogmatic.
What's the significance of all this?
There's a common unity to humankind, to mankind, that I think we're... some of us are aware of, or maybe perhaps always have been aware of, but other people want to stress the differences and the distinctions between different countries and different groups of people, you know, maybe
mm-hmm.
for their own political purposes or whatever. I don't want to speculate on that now.
Yeah.
But I think there really is a common unity and unity of civilization. And my reconstruction, all civilization actually has its origins in a single spot, in a single source, and we're all sort of branches of that. So that's one thing. Another is something we've talked about, which is we go back a lot further and a lot, you know, civilization goes back a lot further than has generally been estimated, and it's a lot more sophisticated. Even if you're using reed boats or rafts to navigate across oceans, is, you know, that takes an incredible amount of sophistication.
Also, foresight.
And foresight, yeah. I mean, I think a lot of sophistication in ancient times was a different, if I could, a different type of sophistication than we're used to in modern times. People now think sophistication is having, you know, Windows XP on their computer. You know, it's a technological type of sophistication versus understanding, for instance, an understanding of astronomy and having a foresight. So the people that, you know, are, and again, I have XP on a computer, but the people that think of that as computers as sophistication, That's very different than someone who can go out and be on the open ocean and figure out exactly where they are and where they're going and have the foresight to figure out, you know, how to make it to, you know, a very small island or a certain region on a continent thousands of miles away. So there's sort of different levels. That's what I'm trying to say, are different types of sophistication.
Or to even want to do it.
Exactly.
And to anticipate the fact that there'll be something there when you get there, wherever there is.
Exactly.
Very brave on top of it. How does religion fit into all of this? Because I was quite taken with your one description you had there. You were talking about the Aztecs and their bloody sacrificial rites. Which were really quite horrendous when you find out what they did. And it suddenly brought to mind that my uncle was head of the Spanish department at Cal Berkeley,
mm-hmm.
and did a lot of translation. And he translated a book called Cortez, The Life of the Conqueror, by his secretary. And the whole book was this diary kept by Cortez's secretary, and my uncle translated it, and the book is still in print. But I was reading that one a while ago, and his descriptions of the Spanish reaction to the violence of the Aztec civilization was really quite amazing, and it tied in perfectly with your description as well. It was pretty bloody. Not all religions were bloody.
No, not all religions were bloody, and not all religions were bloody in a literal sense. Although I've got to say, based on my research, and you know, I don't want to overstress this, but I think part of the message too is that I think that, you know, all the dominant religions, Judaism, Christianity, Islam, etc., they really are rooted in what I would call sky religion, you know, reaching up to the skies.
Mm-hmm.
As we talked about natural catastrophes, the pyramids play a role in that, in trying to reach up to the skies and sort of reunite stability and order mythologically or ritualistically. And all of them, frankly, were fairly bloody. Some were more literally bloody, in my estimation, than others were. The Aztecs are maybe one extreme of literal blood.
Really?
But you know, even when you look at classical Judaism or classical Christianity, I mean, they are bloody religions in the sense of involving sacrifices, not always sacrifices of humans, but in some cases sacrifices of humans, whether it's literally or ritualistically, for instance, in the communion. And the communion, you know, the Catholic or the Christian communion is something that, interestingly, you find in indigenous cultures in many other parts of the world, including the Americas. And I think that goes back to, a common origin, and a common origin that may ultimately have been, as Aztecs continued to express it until the 15th and 16th century, you know, a common origin of actual human sacrifice.
Which they did, in fact, at least from your description, practiced cannibalism as well.
Oh, yeah, and that actually was that cannibalism in the later period, in later Aztec period, is interesting because it was probably both had sort of its ties, in my opinion, in ritualism and the general religion, if we could call it the pyramid religion, for lack of a better term right now, but also probably, you know, ecological reasons.
I mean, what do you mean?
Get more meat into the diet.
Well, that is a source of meat.
Yeah, exactly. And this has been seriously proposed by various anthropologists, nutritionists, that it was a time of stress, and it actually was a way to get more meat into the diet, at least for those that were the dominant, you know, those that won the war. So
of course, that would explain why they died out, because if you wind up killing and eating everybody, you're going to wind up with only two people left.
Right, exactly. And, of course, the Spanish helped.
Well, that's true.
I was going to say, it's also a little bit ironic, I think, sometimes when you look at how bloody the Aztecs and some of the American indigenous cultures were. Now I'm talking 16th century.
Yes.
And so then the Spanish, et cetera, the conquistadors come over, and they're horrified by this. So what do? They massacre them all. You know, they're just as bloody in some cases. But they're doing it for the, quote, right reasons.
Of course, of course. Well, what about the belief, particularly among those groups down there, that they were waiting for the white god to come back from across the sea? And, and I've heard all kinds of theories of you know, that represents Jesus, that represents, you know, the second coming. And what's the origin of that, and how does that fit into any of this?
Well, actually, I think that ties in with ultimately going back to what I was talking about, the migrations or the movements across oceans. And in fact, some of that, if we could use the term myth, some of those myths and traditions were in fact recording real events of people moving across the oceans. I mean, I don't want to play up too much the concept of race, and that had to be a white god, or although that certainly was part of it.
Well, that, at least that's what they believed at that time. I mean, I'm not talking about everybody, but that's theirs.
That's absolutely what they believed, and that in this case would indicate, you know, and you're talking across the Atlantic, essentially Europeans, and that there was a European influence. And that's following up on what we were talking about before, going, you know, there were various periods of migration. So there was the initial, as I see it, migration out of Sundaland, and you're talking, you know, about 4000 BC and earlier. There were other periods of major migration later than that. And again, I correlate that in Voyages of the Pyramid Builders with periods of increased stress, increased catastrophe, increased cometary activity, increased climate changes. So some of these traditions that we're talking about that were recorded in the 16th century, I think, go back to those later periods of migration.
You're a geologist.
Yeah.
Do you see that today we are undergoing more Earth movement activity?
That's a really good question, because a lot of people contend that to be the case.
Seems that way to me.
And it does seem like that way. I don't dismiss that as a distinct possibility.
Uh-oh. We'll pursue that. We're at the top of the hour. I'll give us all a couple of minutes to sort of take a deep breath and try to find out what's next as we continue with our guest, Dr. Robert Schoch, S-C-H-O-C-H. The book is Voyages of the Pyramid Builders. He also wrote Voices of the Rocks. You can get information, of course, from www.robertschoch.homestead.com or check with your bookstore or Amazon. They'll be there. I'm Barbara Simpson. Stay right where you are. We'll be back.
It's time for the February edition.
To talk with Barbara Simpson, call the Wildcard Line at area code 818-501-4109. The first-time caller line is area code 818-501-4721. To talk with Barbara toll-free from east of the Rockies, call 1-800-825-5033. west of the Rockies. Toll free 1-800-618-8255. International callers may reach Barbara by calling the AT&T International Operator and dialing toll free 800-893-0903.
Good morning, everybody. Barbara Simpson here on Coast to Coast AM. We're talking about ancient civilizations that predated the earliest ones that we even knew about, the things that you were taught about in school. And they built pyramids among their other accomplishments. And then as they migrated around the world, they brought with them and left the idea of building pyramids, which is why there are pyramids on every continent except Australia and Antarctica. But they're everywhere else at different times. They look slightly different, but they're pyramids. Who were these people? Why did they move? And what happened to them? We're talking about the book Voyages of the Pyramid Builders with the author, Dr. Robert M. Schock. He also wrote it with Robert Aquinas McNally. We'll continue right here on Coast to Coast AM. Dr. Schock, before the end of the last hour, I had asked you a question about the Earth changes that we seem to be having more of recently. I'm not even at this point even referring to weather, because I think weather is changing, whether climate is changing or not. I guess you can get all kinds of arguments on that, but it just certainly seems as though storms are more fierce and winds are stronger and the blizzards are a little bit worse and the droughts are a little bit worse. But what about the earthquakes and the volcanoes and that type of thing? Do you think we're going into a different Earth cycle where we may be confronting the formidability of nature more than we have been?
It's really, to be honest, it's really hard to know. I mean, I think that's a distinct possibility. I think another possibility is that we are more perceptive of it. Sort of a general rule of thumb in geology, historical geology, is that as things are more recent and closer to you in time, you have more definition of it. You have more perception of the nuances. So what I'm referring to is that I think we're monitoring such things much more accurately.
Dr. Schock, before the end of the last hour, I had asked you a question about the Earth changes that we seem to be having more of recently. I'm not even at this point even referring to weather, because I think weather is changing, whether climate is changing or not. I guess you can get all kinds of arguments on that, but it just certainly seems as though storms are more fierce and winds are stronger and the blizzards are a little bit worse and the droughts are a little bit worse. But what about the earthquakes and the volcanoes and that type of thing? Do you think we're going into a different Earth cycle where we may be confronting the formidability of nature more than we have been?
It's really, to be honest, it's really hard to know. I mean, I think that's a distinct possibility. I think another possibility is that we are more perceptive of it. Sort of a general rule of thumb in geology, historical geology, is that as things are more recent and closer to you in time, you have more definition of it. You have more perception of the nuances. So what I'm referring to is that I think we're monitoring such things much more accurately now, much more precisely. And with our high technological society, very slight changes can have much greater ramifications. I personally fear, if I could use that term, that it's a combination that we're more sensitive, we've got more monitoring of such things, but there may be more changes in an absolute sense also. One thing that we've learned, at least I believe, we've learned is that the Earth system is very, very interconnected between geological changes on the surface of the Earth, climatic changes, astronomical changes in the skies. I mean, all of these systems interrelate to each other, so change in one, like climate, is not incompatible with changes on and within the surface of the Earth. The magnetosphere and the natural magnetism of the Earth, we know fluctuates with time. And when I say no fluctuates with time, within years and decades, and even less than that, and can have major ramifications.
What would happen if that changed? What would happen?
So, for instance, you can have increased amounts of cosmic radiation coming into the system as you change the magnetosphere, and that can then have ramifications in the ecosphere among biological organisms. Hmm. So it can have a cascading or sort of a domino effect. What can sometimes be very small changes can have a triggering effect. It's can be very scary, I think.
We might not need our very own nuclear war to wipe ourselves out, would we?
No. In fact, this is one scary thing. I personally believe that all the evidence indicates in the last couple of hundred years, especially the last 50 years, things like human-induced global climate change are mm-hmm. real. I'm quite aware as a geologist that Earth, independent of humans, has undergone major changes, including major changes in climate, and will continue to do so. But I don't think we can just ignore human effects.
Well, there's certainly, we have, as they say, left our footprint
on the planet. Have. And so we are leaving our footprint and having an effect on global systems.
Mm-hmm.
Plus, every day, every year, we are more at the mercy, should we say, of such things. Especially if you think about, for instance, we're so dependent upon communication. Satellites, for instance, and they are so vulnerable to, as some people would say, the whims of nature.
Yeah. It's amazing. I know here when we have, or anywhere, if you have some type of, whether it's an earthquake or a major fire or something, or remember the New York blackout when the power goes out, I mean, literally our civilization would roll to a stop batteries only last so long.
Exactly. And we are so out of touch with nature. I got to mention this. The Milky Way.
Yeah.
Most people know what the Milky Way is. Many people have never actually seen the Milky Way because we have so much, we're indoor creatures. Plus, if you go outside in most cities, there's so much light pollution, you really can't see it.
Yeah.
So there have been reported cases, for instance, in L.A. where there was a major power outage. Everything went dark. All of a sudden, people see the Milky Way. And in some cases, it's reported they were really scared of it. They thought it was some kind of, like, evil cloud or radiation or who knows what.
Well, you know, my experience...
Because we're so out of touch with nature.
That's true. I was shocked. I took a trip to Australia a number of years ago, and I was on a train trip across what's called the Nullarbor Plain from Perth back. And it's a stretch of desert where there Nullarbor means no trees, and there are no trees for a couple hundred miles at the very least. And I woke up in the middle of the night on the train and just peeked out the window, you know, and just wanted to see if I could see anything. And I literally caught my breath because I never saw a sky like that. It was almost solid white.
Exactly.
As though someone had taken a paintbrush and just slapped paint on the black sky. And I suddenly realized that because I was so far out in the middle of nowhere, there was no light from the ground reflecting. And I was seeing the sky as it is, and I had never seen it before, and it took my breath away. I've never seen anything like that before or since.
Exactly. So take that image or take that thought and then think back thousands of years I mean, they literally, well, in one sense, we see the same sky they saw thousands of years ago, but in another sense, we don't at all.
No, we don't.
We don't at all. Plus,
that's a good point. I never thought of it that way. They saw a lot more simply because they didn't have electricity.
Absolutely. They saw a lot more. And plus, as I outline in the book, I mean, there were things going on in the sky at certain periods. And even if those things were going on now or when they happen, because I think they will return in the not-too-distant future, we're not going to see them the same way they saw them, just because of the factors we're talking about.
Wow. I've got lots more questions, but we also have a lot of callers, so let's get the callers in, too. We have someone on the east of the Rockies line. Caller, what is your name and where are you calling from?
My name is Sino, and I'm calling from Virginia Beach, Virginia.
Hi, go ahead, please.
Well, I guess I just want to run this by as one of my theories. You know, I mean, what if the scientists, archaeologists, and whatnot, what if we've got it all wrong? Okay, I mean, getting back to, like, the Garden of Eden thing, ancient Egypt, so on and so forth. Basically, where I'm coming from is, what if it all started here in the New World, the North American and South American continent? I mean, if you think about this, this could explain the similarities between and why it would appear at times that the Mayan and Aztec civilizations, as well as the Toltecs, were pretty much more advanced in certain things.
Doctor?
Yeah, I actually, you know, my evidence does not suggest that it all began in the Americas. On the other hand, I wouldn't disagree entirely that I think some things may have originated in the Americas and were, you know, migrated or diffused the other way around. And this is a good opportunity I want to take to state that I think there was a diffusion across both oceans into the Americas, but I don't think it was necessarily one way, and I think there are aspects of astronomy, aspects of mathematics, calendar systems, for instance, that there probably is evidence that it diffused the other way. Plus, tying in with what the caller was just saying, as we pointed out earlier, as far as we can determine, the oldest pyramids known may actually be from Peru.
Really?
Americas. Yeah. So, and again, in my opinion, that's because that was a branch out from Sundaland even earlier. But once they were in Peru, they probably was influenced elsewhere in the world. So, I don't totally agree that everything absolutely originated in America. But I also think that there were things that originated in America and spread out.
Would, in terms of age, where does, you said the Sphinx, which is what we started talking about earlier, is that older or younger than those Peruvian
pyramids?
No, that's
older. The Sphinx is older.
The Sphinx is
older, but the Peruvian pyramids are older than the Egyptian pyramids, at least the classic Egyptian pyramids.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah.
Is the Sphinx the oldest man-made structure on the planet?
Well, no, not the oldest man-made structure, but...
what is? Do you know?
No, well, the term is man-made. I mean, there are a lot of man-made things that are very small. Now, as far as big, monumental architectural structures, it certainly is in the running for being the oldest one. It probably is.
Okay. That's a good point. I mean, there were smaller things,
yeah,
too.
Yeah,
there are
lots of smaller things that are older.
All right, let's go to the west of the Rockies line. Caller, good morning. What's your name and where are you?
My name's Bob, and I'm from Monterey, California.
Hi, Bob. Go ahead.
Morning, Barbara.
Good morning.
Doctor, the pyramids that are in Giza, those are similar, I've read, to Orion, the Belt of Orion. What are your thoughts on that?
Oh, absolutely. I agree with that. That is really the work of my friend and colleague, Robert Bouval, who has found correlations between specifically the three major pyramids of Giza and Orion's Belt. But the correlations go way beyond just those three pyramids. And I don't dismiss that. In fact, I think he's absolutely correct that there is a correlation with Orion, and Orion has very powerful mythological and symbolic meanings. It was associated by the ancient Egyptians with Osiris and the Pharaoh, and again, I think ties in with the general concept of sky religion that we've been talking about.
Yeah.
Plus, Orion is recognized, sometimes it's referred to as asterism, you know, sort of a very recognizable type of constellation, and it's recognized around the world, and I don't think that's trivial. As being a man, usually being some kind of hunter, associated with the Pleiades, also, it's one, it seems to be one of these constellations or one of these symbolic forms that is very, very ancient, and we see that in Giza, but we see that elsewhere. A fellow I know, Tom Brophy, has done some very meticulous work on Naptiply, on the calendar circles we were talking about.
Yes.
And he has recognized Orion there, made a very strong case that they recognized Orion 5,000, 6,000, 7,000 B.C. So I think this is another theme that we're seeing throughout a lot of pyramids and ancient cultures.
And just boggles my mind when I think about this. Because the first time caller line, caller, where are you? Where are you calling from? What's your name?
My name's Clay. I'm calling from San Jose.
Hi there. Go ahead.
I got two quick questions. First off, great show.
Thank you.
The doctor's very down to earth.
Yes.
What do you think about Clive Ross's theory regarding the three big pyramids on Giza and their relationship to the angular relationships of the foreigner planets? And the other thing is John Neal, his ancient metrology theory, the global metrology theory that he mm-hmm. has. And I can take that off the air if you want.
Okay, thank you. Doctor?
Yeah, well, I think that there's clear... let me start with the... Well, I'll mention both. I mean, I think there's clear astronomical correlations on the Giza Plateau, as we were talking about with Orion, as far as planetary. And I just mentioned him, Tom Brophy is doing a very, very thorough study of alignments on the Giza Plateau.
Mm-hmm.
And so I want to see what he comes up with. But there's clearly a lot there. I mean, the traditional point of view, should we say, is that things were just put there randomly, or another theory, which I've looked at very carefully as a geologist, is that the pyramids were placed on the Giza Plateau up for basically structural reasons. They were put in the spots they were put because that's where the best bedrock was. In fact, mm-hmm. that doesn't hold up at all.
Oh, it doesn't?
No, it really
doesn't.
That. I mean, yes, the bedrock had to be stable enough for them to be placed, but there were other arrangements that they could have taken. So, I mean, that says to me that they were placed where they were placed for very clear, specific reasons. You don't build a structure like that and just place it randomly.
But, I mean, if they were aligning it with Orion in some way, what was the purpose of it? I mean, was it something in terms of looking at the sky, or was it lined in with their religion, or was it just the mystery of the power of nature, or will we ever know?
I think it was both looking at the sky, recording things in the sky, predictive value to a certain extent. In fact, your last caller, I think, was alluding to that. I hate using the term because we always give things a wrong connotation when we try to compare them to modern.
Yeah.
But basically, astronomical observations. I think those astronomical observations and predictions were part of the Giza Plateau
mm-hmm.
Situation. I mean, for instance, and some of my colleagues have done more work than I on this aspect, if you take the pyramids and when they were unfinished structures, the alignments of the shafts and galleries would have been very useful for predicting and observing the skies. So there's that aspect. As far as sort of a universal system of units around the world, which has been suggested, I think that has to be looked at very closely. I don't.
What is that?
Basically, that there are certain units of length that we find around the world, in particular certain units of area, certain units of time, that are common to civilizations globally. Standard devices. I mean, we have that now in modern terms in the metric system.
Yeah.
But we know exactly where that came from, you know, late 18th century France. But in fact, standards of units of measurement that go back to ancient times, you know, it's not just arbitrary. It's not a situation where every civilization has its own arbitrary units.
They're the similar and or they're the same.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that ties right in with the concept of migration and contact and connection and ideas, thoughts, systems, both technology, culture, religion, diffusing throughout the world in ancient times, that there were these connections.
Wow, that's amazing. Let's see if we can get another call in on the wild card line. Caller, what's your name? Where are you?
This is Will from Madison, Wisconsin. Hi, and hello, Dr. Shock.
Hello.
In another book, Our Secret Origins, History Exposed, another author raises the hypothesis that it was actually Finno-Ugric peoples that sailed about the world and built some of the pyramids based on both base roots of words and also genetic markers. And it was
okay. Hold your thought there. I hear the music. We're at the bottom. I'll take you as soon as we come back. Try to sum it up in a nice brief question for us, Will, and Dr. Shock will answer it right here on Coast to Coast AM. I'm Barbara Simpson. Will from Wisconsin, who has a question he'd like to ask Dr. Shock. Will, go ahead, please.
Yes, I have one straightforward question. Whereas Tacitus, in his book Germania, wrote that the Finno-Ugric Estonians, long ago before the Celts, were in England and Ireland, and the Finno-Ugric stretch all the way over to the Ainu in Japan, what is your evidence that, in fact, it was not the Finno-Ugrics, but the Celts that sailed about the world and built the pyramids and left base root words for many words in every different language?
Okay, well, let me clarify. I'm actually not arguing that the Celts were the only ones that were moving around or exclusive ones. So I don't dismiss other possibilities, as you're mentioning. And I don't think it goes, I'm not saying that all goes back to the Celts. We were just talking about the Celts at one point from about 1000 BC. I think it goes back much earlier than that, as we were discussing an hour or two ago, with really originating from the area of Sundaland, from was really now the Indonesian Borneo area, originally going back 6,000, 7,000 years ago, and then spreading from there. And what you're referring to and what I was referring to with the Celts would really be later offshoots or branches of movement.
Would you know, one thing we really didn't touch on, just very briefly, what about language?
Oh, language is absolutely fascinating. I do talk about that some in Voyages of the Pyramid Builders. And in fact, there are common root words that you can find throughout essentially all the languages of the world that are still spoken to this day. I mean, everyone is probably familiar with the concept going back 200 years of Indo-European based language for that group of languages, but what's now been found among linguists, certain linguists, is that there was probably a common global language, a common world language, going back tens of thousands of years, and you can if you're very careful tracing the language families back, you can find common root words that are found in all the languages, which again I think ties in with the general theme that I and others have been discovering and promoting, that we go back to this common origin, at least.
It's amazing. It's going to rewrite all the textbooks, that's for sure. We have to take a quick break. We'll be right back with our guest. I'm Barbara Simpson. To the phones with my guest, we have caller on the east of the Rockies line. Caller, where are you and what's your name?
My name is Toy, and I'm in Tulsa.
Okay, Toy, go ahead.
All right, my question is for Mr. Shock. Pyramids, what if any connection do they might have to Mars? The Egyptians, do you think they might have seen what might be on the Mars surface, what might be revealed on television today? And do you think the Egyptians used ground energy or zero-point energy in their pyramids, kind of like they did in the Old Testament with the Tabernacle or the Ark of the Covenant? And that's it. And I'll listen off the air. Thanks.
Okay, thank you. What about Mars? What about the planets? What about interstellar life?
Yeah, well, okay, let me I'll make a couple of comments on that. First, I think I'm just absolutely fascinated by the concept of interstellar extraterrestrial, you know, non-Earth life. And absolutely, you know, I do not dismiss the possibility at all.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, some people have made a connection between the Giza pyramids, and I think this is what the caller was alluding to, the Giza pyramids and, for instance, pyramid-type structures that are found on Mars, for instance, in what's known as the Cydonia region of Mars.
Right.
And even the name of Cairo, some people have connected with Mars. And there are a lot of tantalizing potential connections there. Now, on the other hand, I must say that that's not something I've really, well, I know, I've certainly looked into it. I know a lot about it. It's not really the focus of my research at the moment.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not.
Is it possible?
I don't exclude it as a possibility, but I'm not convinced that correlations are. Right now I think they need more exploration.
Okay.
They need more research. So I wouldn't exclude it, but I'm not absolutely convinced either at the moment.
What about the energy issue?
I'm sorry?
What about the energy issue with the pyramids?
Yeah, that's the other thing that the caller asked about, whether the pyramids were somehow funneling energy, it's actually been suggested, by, for instance, by Chris Dunn, that Giza was a power plant.
Right.
He has a book called that.
He's been on my program.
Yeah. I don't want to, I'm certainly not going to dismiss the very meticulous good work that he's done. On the other hand, that's not been the focus of my research so far.
Possible?
I would say I don't exclude it as a possibility. I'm not convinced at the
mm-hmm.
moment. He has focused, if we talk about Chris Dunn's work in particular, he's focused primarily, I believe, on the Great Pyramid.
Yes.
And the structure of the Great Pyramid, and I think he considers many of the other pyramids to be, how should we say, non-functional, and I don't want to speak for him,
mm-hmm.
but sort of imitations, but not functional in the sense of a power plant, as he believes for the Great Pyramid. I'm honestly not absolutely convinced that that's the primary or major or even, the function of any of the pyramids.
That's okay. There are lots of theories out there.
That's exactly it. I mean, again, I don't want to belittle or dismiss them because I think that's not appropriate either. I think we need to explore the different possibilities.
Okay.
But am I convinced of a very specific Mars connection? No, am I convinced of a very specific sort of power plant, let's put it that way, power plant connection, no.
Okay, let's go to another caller west of the Rockies. Where are you, caller? What's your name?
This is Mike calling from Seattle.
Hi, Mike. Go ahead.
I got a couple questions. One is anyone trying to excavate the chamber under the Sphinx I mean, it seems crazy enough that somebody would, you know, prophesy about that thing and then science verify it later, let alone the other ramifications. Mm-hmm. And also, are there any other pyramids that were found to also line up with the constellation Orion, or is it just the three and Orion's belt?
Okay, good questions. You mentioned earlier we were talking about
right.
the Sphinx. Just briefly, tell us about whether they have dug underneath.
No, to my knowledge, and I hope I wouldn't find out, no one has excavated into that chamber that we found. No one has pursued that further.
Okay.
I would like to personally or at least see that it was done, but it hasn't yet. And I understand that the Egyptian authorities are very hesitant to open up new projects. And we did discuss earlier in the show a couple of hours ago how it could, in fact, if there's materials in it and it's not done properly, it could be very dangerous and damaging to whatever might be in it. So they're not in any and it can, from the outside, it can seem almost crazy, but they're in no rush to open up new things. In fact, some Egyptian authorities would like to impose essentially a moratorium on new excavations and try to take care of what they've got already.
Well, from what I've heard, their museums are full.
Exactly.
Anyway, it's a real problem they have just for storage.
Yes, exactly. Now, they are building a new multi-million dollar museum outside of the Giza Plateau, close to the Giza Plateau. I don't know what the current status of that is. But that's certainly under...
It's a good sign.
That's a good sign. But all these things cost money, too, and to do them correctly, it costs a lot of money.
You bet. Let's go to first-time caller line. And what's your name, caller? Where are you?
Hi, my name's Dave. I'm in Tucson, Arizona.
Hi, Dave. Go ahead.
I would have to disagree with your guest tonight about the concept of a spreading of a pyramid building culture. Really, I think the answer is quite simple, why you see so many pyramids throughout the world. If you live in a low technology society, you have only copper tools, you only have stone, you don't have the arch or even the wheel, you want to build a great structure, a tall structure in particular, the only shape that you could come up with would be a pyramid shape.
Yeah, I'm glad actually that you brought this question up, because I wouldn't disagree with you if it were nothing more than pyramids and that it was just a superficial resemblance of pyramids around the world. Just to elaborate a little bit, I try to develop in Voyages of the Pyramid Builders a lot more evidence than just the pyramids appearing around the world. I try to look at all kinds of different technology and mythology and ritual and physical evidence that I believe indicates diffusionism around the world. If it were simply pyramids and nothing else, I would absolutely agree with you. In fact, that was my initial impression when I got into this business, should we say, that it's just a very stable form of pyramid. And if you want to build a tall structure, there's only so many different ways you can do it. But I've become convinced when I start looking at both the details of the pyramids and the cultures that were building them and the evidence that we have when we put it all together that, in fact, it's more than just a superficial resemblance.
Thank you, Dave, for that. And take a look at the book. I think you'll find it fascinating. I want to ask you, Doctor, before we totally run out of time, are you still planning to take the pyramid trip to Mexico in May and June?
Yeah, I'm hoping to.
Is this open to the public?
It is open to the public. If people want to email me, I can give them more details. But I'm interested in all pyramids. But right now, I've been doing some focused work on some of the Mexican pyramids.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm planning to, at this point, I hate to say the future seems so unstable sometimes with impending wars and whatnot, but I know how that is. I mean, I was in Egypt just after the last Iraq, what did they call it, the Gulf War.
Mm-hmm.
So you can't let those things stop you sometimes.
So it's shock at, S-C-H-O-C-H, at B-U dot E-D-U.
Correct.
Is that right?
Yes, my last name, S-C-H-O-C-H at B-U edu, and people can feel free to email me, and I can give them information about that, or if they have more questions, I'm happy to get emails.
You may get inundated. By the way, the website
it's just I said that, but I mean,
you may be sorry.
Honestly, anyone can find me through the Internet World Wide Web. Obviously, I'm a faculty member at Boston University. If anyone goes to the Boston University website and looks me up in the directory, they'll find me.
There you'll be, and it's www.robertshock.homestead.com.
Right.
And just so people remember, it's Voyages of the Pyramid Builders, and the publisher is Tarcher Putnam, and it's available Amazon, your bookstore. And also another book that he wrote was Voices of the Rocks, which sort of ties into this as well. We have another caller on the East of the Rockies line. Caller, where are you and what's your name?
Name's Will from Glencoe, Alabama, WAAX Guest, Alabama.
Good, thank you.
Well, with great respect, Dr. Shock, I've watched you on some of the A&E specials and other things.
Oh, thank you.
And especially appreciate your opinion about Yonaguni and the unorthodox view that you've taken, not putting up with the dogma about the pyramids. But now, as a devil's advocate, I have about the same question that Dave did.
Mm-hmm.
Like here in Alabama, we have mounds from the Mississippian period, they say.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah, the mounds are pyramid shaped.
Mm-hmm.
Teepees are pyramid shaped. The so-called pyramids in northern Peru, now they're built, they don't have the tops of them, but they're built out of mud.
Mm-hmm.
Like, essentially like the ziggurats are. There's
mm-hmm.
no other way to build a building like that. It's, it's an extremely common structure.
Yeah, no, I like I said before, I would not disagree with you in, that is something that was my initial impression. That was always my first impression. That tends to be the traditional view. And if, like I said before, if there was nothing more to it than the general shape and structure, because I mean, architecturally and from an engineering point of view, that's what works. I would just dismiss this, but that's why I think sometimes you really have to dig deeper, and that's what I've tried to do, to look at commonalities. Also, I'll make another point, that even though there is sort of a structurally only so many ways you can do it, there are some variations on the theme of how you can do it. And one thing I've tried to point out, for instance, is that where on other bases I think there are cultural connections and similarities, for instance, in ritual and details of technology, you also find similarities in some of the details of the pyramid building. Just as a quick, for instance, the pyramids in China that we know from the late centuries B.C. Are very, very similar, not just on a superficial level, but some of the techniques of structure. And there's more than one way to build a pyramid, to some of the Mexican pyramids from just about the same time period and slightly later. And in fact, there's lots of evidence, as I outline in the book, that there was a Chinese Mesoamerican connection.
It's amazing. So
again, I would not agree with you or the previous caller if that's all there was to it. But I think, and I try to outline that in the book, Voyages of the Pyramid Builders, that there is a lot more to it than just a superficial similarity.
That's what makes the whole thing so fascinating. Why did people forget what they knew? I mean, you were talking before about the difference in the boats. You know, they used the reed boats. And then the Europeans used wooden boats that filled up with water and could sink. There seems to be a gap somewhere where you have all of this migration and the similarity of the pyramid and other things, and then there's a big hole, and then we seem to have started all over again at different places.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is not an uncommon theme in history and civilization generally, that you have periods of ascendancy, should we say, and then periods... Generally, you know, people use terms like dark ages. One very specific reason, and I do talk about this in the book, is that in the 6th century AD, we went into a major dark age.
Mm-hmm.
That's a classical time. In terms of traditional history, that's the end of the classical ancient times. We went into a major dark age that we didn't really come out of for close to 1,000 years. And actually, as I discuss in the book, that ties in with major climatic changes, with observations of comets in the sky.
Go back to that again, huh?
Here. Yeah, so I mean, there were real physical changes in the Earth system in the 6th century AD that have been documented by myself and others that set off that decline in dark ages, and why, you know, Europe and other portions of the world sort of enclosed in upon themselves and
mm-hmm.
were no longer traveling these distances, lost a lot of the technology. A lot of these things you lose if you don't use them.
That's true.
Technology.
Use it or lose it. Doctor, I hear the music. That means we're at the top of the hour. The rest of the callers, I'm sorry we couldn't get to everybody, but thank you so much for listening and calling. Dr. Shock, thanks for being with us. Again, the name of his book, Voyages of the Pyramid Builders. His name, Robert M. Shock, S-C-H-O-C-H. I got it right, S-C-H-O-C-H. I'm Barbara Simpson, and I'll be back with you next weekend, Saturday and Sunday evenings. Looking forward to that, as always, being with you on Coast. You can reach me at Barbara@coasttocoastam.com. Check my Monday column regularly on worldnetdaily.com. And, of course, the new website, coasttocoastam.com. I want to thank my whole weekend crew, Gina, Rob, Kiris, and Dave, and, of course, all of you for listening and being with us. See you next weekend. Be careful what you pray for. You might get it.